Exactly. All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the March 31st strategic planning meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would, please all rise and follow me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, and Madam Clerk, we have a change to the agenda.
We have an added item under closed session, under pending litigation, A, conference with legal counsel, number 17, Barron, Robert, and Madonna versus R.W. Hertel and Sons Incorporated et al. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied, as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. That's it.
Thank you. I have County Council's light on, but didn't see any great intent to speak, so all right, we'll clear that. I do have quite a number of requests to speak in public comment. Let me ask, are there any others in the audience who are holding slips that would like to speak? And with that, and seeing the ones that come to the dais, I'm going to go ahead and close the acceptance of slips for public comment. I believe we can get through the ones we have and get on to our morning's business. So with that, we'll start with Richard Margetson, followed by Keith Weimer. Well, you're on the top of the list, Mr. Are you ready to speak? Mr. Weimer, followed by Gwen Taylor.
Honorable Supervisors, my name is Keith Weimer, Los Osos Sustainability Group. The most recent NWRI report for the Los Osos Wastewater Project states, cost estimates should be stated clearly and compared on an equivalent basis with the same degree of variability and specificity. Refined and updated cost estimates are needed for each alternative so that decision makers and stakeholders can make informed judgments. The only way this can happen is through the design-build process. The community survey is inaccurate and biased, and I provided some reasons for saying this. That is just the tip of the iceberg, by the way. A few weeks ago, I provided you a list of ways the process has been biased in favor of the 95% MHW gravity design and against STEP. This is really all about process and the $7 million of the money that has been spent on an equal alternatives analysis. Every time we brought up what we knew to be exaggerated costs about STEP and the arbitrary requirements that would raise the cost of STEP, the project team has said the design-build process would resolve those concerns. Now we expect follow-through. The $200,000 it will cost for another RFP or $400,000 if two RFPs are needed would be the wisest money spent on this process so far to remove a cloud over the process. Also, since STEPSTEG may come in as the low bid, it will tend to increase competition and project affordability. You haven't gone against one staff recommendation on the project so far. It's time to show you're the deciders. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weimer. Ms. Taylor, followed by Al Barrow.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor. I'm a resident of Los Osos. Last week, the Board of Supervisors amended an agreement for environmental counseling services with Michael Brandeman and Associates. That sum of money was $283,843.40. Unfortunately, this amount of money was only for a few of the additional projects that they, Michael Brandeman, felt needed to be addressed. One of them was groundwater quality water supply. In the report that they submitted to this board, it They said as follows. The MBA team identified a need for the county to revise and rerun its numerical groundwater flow model to provide additional information for the groundwater study. The team's review and assessment of the additional groundwater model results into the hydrological study required an increased level of effort that was not originally budgeted. Additionally, the county added a wastewater treatment plant at Tonini, which required an evaluation that was not part of the original scope of work. Our community services district was in the process of developing a sewer project in which there were numerous contractors involved. One of them was a contractor who is now on the short list and on the regular list, Montgomery Watson Harza. They sued and are in court. They are bankruptcy court at this present time. And yet you are allowing this organization, this engineering firm, to be on the list, to be part of the contract for the development of the new sewer facilities. I suggest strongly that you take a second look at this. You don't want some organization, engineering firm, such as that, no matter how qualified they appear to be on this team that is going to develop the sewer project for Los Osos. That's wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Barrow, followed by Elaine Watson.
Good morning. My name is Al Barrow. Good to see your bright, shining faces this morning. You're ready to roll up your sleeves and get this budget straightened out. I won't try to be as short as I can. As far as the Los Osos Wastewater Project, as it relates to the Coastal Development Permit, there was an 11-page letter, which I emailed you all, from the Coastal Commission, stating that the four projects that were reviewed in the EIR were not permittable. I'm sorry, folks. You got Swiss cheese for a project right now. And 11 pages of comments are a lot of pages, and they make a lot of requirements. And I think you all should read that as soon as you possibly can. At least scan it, please. It's in your mailbox. Best value. To get the best value of a project, which is the stated mission of this project, you would have to have WM Lyles on your short list of contractors because they're the only ones that really have a specialist in step steg on their team. The county has stated that in an email to the sustainability group that they were not going to recommend any more step steg work. I think that is a huge mistake. The county also interviewed Lyle, and he said that he could guarantee that his cost would be 20% less than the other team's gravity, 20% less. Now, that included the on-site cost as well, which would bring that up to about 40%. A 40% savings for best value is really important that you don't exclude this. And I think one of the prior speakers alluded to that, the first speaker. So I think that's seriously important. Mr. Ripley, who was on the team, said that they would be saving $100 a month. That's $100 of $240 is about 40%. So that's a large number to ignore. And if you read the report, there are many things about the project that are flawed. As also reported earlier, the survey was flawed, and I had a professional look at it, and he said the way you listed the six question could have sent everybody in a certain direction. So I would say Coastal Commission, Step Steg Team, Lyle Group, you should consider keeping them on your team. It's very important that we make this as affordable as possible. As far as grant money is concerned, the state revolving fund managers told me that they have $2 billion worth of applications for about $150 billion worth of giveaway for the stimulus package. That's not a very big percentage, stacked up with 40% savings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Ms. Watson, followed by Dr. Mary Fullwood.
morning. Elaine Watson, Los Osos. The survey asked the community to make a decision between the environmentally preferred project and a step system separated according to this brochure by only a slight difference. According to the brochure on page 11, the EIR needs to identify an environmentally superior alternative. As discussed earlier, the EIR concluded that all of the four alternatives were similar in their impacts and they all met the project objectives and were feasible. The NWRI analysis on page 6 of this resulted in their recommendation that either step or gravity would be feasible and believe that either cost estimates, better cost estimates and community input would decide between the two. Therein lies the problem. Even though the stated difference between the two systems was almost negligible, there was no side-by-side pro-con comparison. The TAC did do a head-to-head cost analysis, but it didn't get much play. If the differences between the two are as minimal as this brochure indicates, why weren't they evaluated equally through the design-build process that was promised? As for community input, the results of the survey tell us that 70-plus percent of the people that filled out their surveys did it on the basis of the county literature and the newspapers. It's been alleged here before that the plan has always been going to be a gravity system. In fact, you've been shown video footage of Noel King and others saying just that. The selection of Montgomery Watson Harza makes this an even more substantial allegation. You don't want this perception to persist. You have the opportunity to dispel this. Since the cost of the project was the number one concern on the community survey, why don't we know exactly just what the actual cost differences are through a fair, unbiased design-build process? It's $7 million later, and a fair analysis was the whole point. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. Dr. Fullwood, followed by Richard Margetson's not in the room now, so we'll go next with Eric Greening, please.
Good morning. My name is Dr. Mary Fullwood, the Los Osos representative for San Luis Bay Chapter of Surfrider Foundation and the Sierra Club rep on the Marine Interests Group. We are disappointed with Public Works' recommendation not to advance a STEP-STEG team to the RFP process of the Los Osos Wastewater Project, and we encourage you at your April 7 meeting to exercise your discretion over staff's recommendation. Surfrider and Sierra Club reiterate our previous request that the RFQ shortlist include competitive teams representing all viable technologies to compete within the RFP process. We continue to maintain that STEP-STEG in this setting and topography is environmentally and potentially economically superior to a gravity system. Public Works continues to maintain the opposite. On the matter of economics, at least, a resolution to that disagreement is at hand in the RFP process, but not if the direct cost comparison is not allowed to happen. Staff's rationale for not including a STEP-STEG design-build team is not persuasive. The NWRI determined that both technologies are viable. In the community survey, 46% of those surveyed expressing a preference for gravity said they would prefer STEP if the cost was $30 a month cheaper. 9% would choose STEP no matter what the cost. Those two numbers combined mean the majority would select STEP if the price were right. That a STEP team could not guarantee such a price is irrelevant, as no bids will be formal until all have been evaluated through the RFP. If all viable technologies compete within the RFP, the community will see actual designs and costs, which would provide a basis for a more accurate assessment of the community's preferences. A year ago, your board stressed the importance of assisting in Los Osos' healing. The only way this will occur is by allowing both STEP-STEG and gravity sewer teams to submit bids so the people of Los Osos can base one of the largest financial decisions of their lives on something more than hypothetical inquiries. Only real numbers and designs will bring you the healing we all seek and not more harm. Why would you choose otherwise? We do not want your process to be derailed. We want it to be what it was promised to be: transparent, thorough, and fair. please keep your promise and vote next week to advance a STEP STEG team to the RFP shortlist, allowing them to compete in designing a project for the LOWWP. Los Osos truly deserves this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fullwood. Mr. Greening, followed by Carol Maurer. And I did receive one late request to speak, and I'm sorry, Mr. Perlman, I'd closed acceptance because we have quite a long bit of public comment today. But appreciate you being here. Mr. Greening, followed by Carol Maurer.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, not from Los Osos. I'm from Atascadero. I'm one of the 94% of the county's people who don't live in Los Osos, and I came with a non-Los Osos issue. But I guess I should say that my told you so certainly is playing out. When you took this project on, you did add a full-time job to the more than full-time job you already had. And frankly, it's happening to me, too. I'm a member of the Water Resources Advisory Committee, and this Saturday in this very room, we're going to be having a special meeting about that project. And so I am trying to come up to speed on it and listening to all points of view, and I certainly would welcome the chance then to hear all points of view, with the caveat that our focus is water, not the whole picture, certainly not who did or didn't do what to whom, but what will be best, the best solution for a water basin that is at level of 3 certified severity and is has issues with seawater intrusion as well as nitrates. That said, and that will be at 8:30 Saturday, Water Resources Advisory Committee here. That said, the issue I did come with, a few weeks ago I was discussing the question of late submission of materials and when a policy might be set on that topic. And I got an oral response that that discussion might happen today, but I don't see anything in the agenda to reflect that. And obviously, there's more than enough budget stuff on everybody's plate to plow through. So are we to assume then that that discussion will happen at another time? And if so, when? Because I think it is important. Certainly, you can't give over the transom documents the kind of attention that they need if you're making a decision that day. And so I'm hoping that we can develop a policy that allows response to information whenever it comes, but gives a long enough timeline that the public has a chance to respond to staff reports in a way that gives you time to respond to their responses, and then allows the final discussion to be on the oral level right here at the hearing chambers the day that the decision is made. So anyway, if you can, please let us know when that discussion will take place. I'm assuming it's not today. Thank you.
Correct. I can respond to your request for responses, Mr. Greening, that Mr. Jensen County Council has just delivered me a draft of the late document submission policy. Came yesterday, or maybe it was the day before, and we'll be getting that together and getting it on an agenda here before too long. Thank you. Ms. Maurer, followed by David Dugan.
Thank you. Carol Maurer, Los Osos. Pavo Ogren has stated that the people of Los Osos are extremely knowledgeable about sewer technologies and the history of the sewer projects in Los Osos. As chair of the Los Osos Community Advisory Council for Los Osos, I hear testimony at our meetings from many of these same knowledgeable people at every meeting on the importance of comparing the final total costs of alternative sewer technologies that many people claim are cheaper than the conventional systems. I see residents of Los Osos in agony over the prospect of paying for a system that might be the most expensive sewer ever installed in a town our size, especially when no one has proven that this expensive conventional system is the only one that can comply with the requirements given to us by the Regional Water Quality Control Board. We need to see for ourselves which total project is truly the most affordable for our town. Furthermore, since the DEIR did not include a section on the economics of alternative technologies, there has been no comparative analysis provided to you or the community at all that indicates that the gravity collection BioLac oxidation ditch treatment Tonini spray fields and Broderson disposal, in other words, the proposed project, is really the preferred project for Los Osos when it comes to the economics of the project. Other technologies have been routinely dismissed or put down with wording that is intended to sway people towards acceptance of gravity collection. The survey was so biased against STEP-STEG that it was no surprise that the results came out in favor of gravity. It's completely unfair to use these survey results as proof that Los Osos wants a gravity system. More than anything, it's the bottom line that will sway people's opinion. We can't guess at this cost comparison. Companies that design, manufacture, and install alternative systems must be included in the RFP process. Isn't it only fair that we look at the true bottom line of alternative proposals? Isn't a cost comparison what people in Los Osos have been asking for and waiting a long time for? This community will never heal the wounds of divisiveness without this comparison. Therefore, I urge you to include at least one STEP system vendor and preferably one other alternative system in your short list of bidders for the Los Osos wastewater project that you are scheduled to approve next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maurer. Mr. Dugan, followed by Lindy Owen.
Hey, Dugan, Los Osos. Fallacy, an opinion or argument that is deductively invalid. In this case, relevant evidence that has been ignored or suppressed. Fallacies in the Los Osos Wastewater Project Community Advisory Opinion Study. Fallacies of an opinion due to the evidence that is ignored. That's spelled wrong too. Section 1, Sample 1, Survey Participation, and you should have a copy of this. Page 10, paragraph 1, line 5. However, to underscore how the group differs in sentiment from community members who will not be responsible for a majority portion of the cost, renters living in the prohibition zone. Why is this a fallacy? Renters in the prohibition zone could pay and will pay proportionally higher rents due to the cost passed on by the property owner. Same section, page 10, paragraph 1, line 11. Not assessment group. Renters in the prohibition zone and owners and renters not in the prohibition zone. To group the renters of the prohibition zone with those outside the prohibition zone belies the facts that those renters or new renters that take the place of ousted renters because of higher rents could be and will be paying proportionally higher rents due to the costs passed on by property owners. Fallacies of an opinion due to suppressed evidence. Collection systems. Questions and answers of the collection systems become moot if an alternative is purposely eliminated for consideration. As you know, the vacuum collection system was eliminated by county staff prior to the hiring of Carrillo Engineer Consulting Services. It wasn't included in the RFQ, and not being included, not one construction company qualified to install a vacuum collection system did not offer you a vacuum collection system prohibition zone-wide. If the information is excluded from the beginning, how can an objective analysis of the alternatives be presented to the public? This flaw alone makes the opinion survey invalid. Next meeting, I'll be talking about treatment technologies. I just want to make sure that you understand that the more staff cuts corner or tries to circumvent the process, there are going to be more and more challenges. This project is going to be stopped dead in its tracks with people with appeals and lawsuits. And I'm sure you don't want that to happen. County staff has stated from the beginning they want gravity from the very beginning, the onset of the whole process. Vacuum system has to be part of the process. The costs have to be evenly compared to gravity. It needs to be presented to the public, and I don't believe that the $7 million that you've spent already has been wisely spent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan. Ms. Owen, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from the Prohibition Zone in lovely Los Osos. I wanted to start off just reminding everybody why we are doing a wastewater project. It is because we are have high nitrates, which are an indicator of other pollutants that could be in a water supply. The interesting fact is that our nitrates have remained level and are actually decreasing slightly. The highest nitrates are right below Cabrillo Estates near Sea Pines Golf Course, which is not even in the Prohibition Zone. With that nitrate level removed from the overall nitrates, we are actually under the legal amount of nitrates. So when we call this an emergency, a disaster, polluting the bay, which there to date is very little, there's actually no evidence of pollution in the bay, and there is no evidence that septic tanks do not process the waste through the vadose zone, which is usually 2 to 3 feet. So I want to go back and say the STEP system, the Los Osos CSD paid $500,000 to Ripley and Company to come up with a STEP plan, and it's a beautiful plan, and it's been thrown in the trash, basically, through this process. Corolo did not have any interest in looking at it. They could have gotten numbers out of it. They could have gotten a lot of information to set two projects side by side, so you could actually say what's right with this, what's wrong with this, and then compare gravity to this alternative that everybody keeps asking for it. But, you know, as long as Corolo is in charge of it and they're not interested in it, then you're not going to see it, and our community is upset that we didn't get to see it. All the newspaper articles that keep coming out talk about, you know, even in this statement here where the comment is, our unique project approach took extraordinary efforts to engage the community, review and analyze all viable technologies, and develop a competitive design-build process aimed at driving project costs down. None of that happened. That's all bogus. That is spin. We did not get a process, and we want a process. I'm extremely scared that what's going to happen is you're going to use this survey, which has been deemed bogus by two experts who have looked it over and said it was biased from, you know, all the questions are basically trying to push people towards supporting a gravity system. And then from there, you're going to go ahead and say that the Tonini spray fields probably won't work, so maybe we need to go back to the Midtown site and do the old project all over again. My suspicion is that the pipes, when you went to look at a new project, the pipes all go to the middle of town instead of being rerouted to go all the way out of town. So my suspicion is now strong that Montgomery Watson will again get the project and they will build it in the middle of town. You know, it's a bait and switch situation.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Time is up. Mr. DeFatta, followed by Richard Margetson.
Good morning, Supervisors. Ben DeFatta here from Los Osos again. Los Osos is not your ATM machine. Here we are at the threshold of a depression with the loss of many jobs. The government is trillions of dollars in debt. This state is billions of dollars in debt. This county is millions of dollars in debt. And our citizens are thousands of dollars in debt to where living a comfortable life is near impossible. All this will be paid by the citizens of the United States and this county and the state. When the property owners receive next year's property tax bill, they will be paying more for the sewer assessment for sewer than the tax on their property, at least $3,000 to $4,000 a year more. The first job of our government is to preserve the society and country, not tax us to death. In hard times, we have to spend less, and so should government. If you don't have it, you don't go out and use your credit card like a drunken sailor. Well, the federal government, this state, and this county has reached deep in your pocket and is using your credit card whether you like it or not. After all this time last week, we found out the county, or I should say Mr. Gibson and his sidekick and his three merry men on our payroll, who's supposed to steal from the rich not and give to the poor, and not from the poor and give to the rich, that the county collection system was going to be the only system for Los Angeles. Lived down there 50 years. For Los Osos and nothing else. From you can't cross a creek with a sewer pipe Bianchi to Noel King who said gravity is what you're going to get and that's it. To no thanks to Gibson and sidekick Ogren and probably Briggs too, we're going to get the most expensive sewer project in the country per capita. Totally forgetting that as many as 3,000 of our neighbors will be thrown out of their homes. Many will be homeless or end up looking for apartments, which there aren't enough of, or homes out of state. 2 weeks ago, when the costly flood survey came out, everybody could see that information on affordable projects never was mentioned. Cost was conveniently left out. How could anybody make an educated decision with this rigged survey, was this done on purpose? You bet. I'm going to have to skip a lot of things here. I'm not an obstructionist, but many homeowners and renters who are just trying to survive this ordeal are very mad at you supervisors and county. The scoreboard, forget that. I know you other four supervisors will be using your wisdom to decide the fate of at least 3,000 homeowners and renters, where many just want to live out their remaining days in some kind of peace. Thank you. Thank you, Father.
Thank you, Mr. DeFada. Mr. Margetson, followed by Chris Allaby.
Richard Margetson, sorry I wasn't ready earlier. I wanted to verify something before I gave public comment. The survey, if you look at it just on its face, gave you what you probably wanted. Verification that gravity is the preferred choice. But I think you need to delve into this survey and look at the numbers. I've spent some time last night doing that. There's a question dealing with the age of the respondents and the effectiveness of the survey on page 12 of the survey results. In the category of under age 44, only 10% of the 2,700 respondents were under the age of 44. 270 of those that were returned were under 44. That's your working families. That's your families with children that are just trying to survive in Los Osos with one or two jobs, who may not have had time to fill out the survey, have not had time to gather the information. You did not hit this population with this survey. They may have received one, but you didn't get to them. Of that same age category, if you add in 54 and younger, the number only increases to 725 out of 2,700 responses. That's your pre-retirement age category. 55 and older, you're starting to get into that early retirement age. This survey did not hit the people, and the responses you got did not come from the people who are going to be most affected by this project. As you go further in the analysis on page 13, it talks about income distribution. 45% of those paying for this sewer project fall in the income category of 49%, or $49,000 income, annual income, or lower. At a $49,000 annual income, this sewer project at $250 a month will cost them anywhere from 6 to 20% of their household income, if the lowest income is the poverty level. From the poverty level to 49,000, you're from 6 to 20% of household income will go to pay for this project. My last comment, we keep hearing about the minority in Los Osos. Well, the minority that moved the sewer out of town in this survey was justified. 10%, 270 people wanted it in the middle of town.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson.
The rest wanted it out of town.
I'm afraid your time is up. Thank you. Mr. Allaby, followed by Chuck Sasania.
Chris Allaby, CDO number 1019. Going back in ancient history, this project started under a cloud with the county claiming we had poisonous water and the good burgers of Los Osos doing their own survey, whatever, finding out that it wasn't. There were permits issued for septic tanks, and evidently nobody checked to see that they put septic tanks into some of these residences that are that got leach pits installed, except the county was the one that issued the permits for these things. They should be responsible for them. Every soil and water scientist that has any real standing that our groups have interviewed have stated that the system we have now is the most efficient, including Dr. Ruhr's report of a couple of years ago. I've got this, bidding process here with Montgomery Watts and Harza being involved. These are the people that prevented our CSD from being present at the bidding conferences. They were physically restrained from entering, and then they after the recall vote came in, the same outfit, Montgomery Watson Harza, had a burglary in their business office where only the business records were stolen. Strange burglars. Here they are again around. They're taking the step stay off the table for us. That's nice. Okay, the survey had no on-site information at all in it or discussed at all. Affordability, a dead issue. So far, no grants, no interest loans of our own money. Seawater intrusion is being ignored. The water that could be used to help correct this is to be disposed of on spray fields, if not recovered. I don't know how many people on the county or the county staff have CDOs or live in the prohibition zone, but unless you do, you can't imagine the onerous cost this is going to be for everyone. This thing, $300 a month, is thrown away to flush your toilets, and especially considering the current national problems. I mean, there's a lot of people in this.
Thank you, Mr. Albee. I'm afraid your time is up. Mr. Cesania, followed by Gail McPherson.
Good morning, Board. My name is Chuck Cesania. I am a member of the Board of Directors, Los Osos Community Services District. I'm not speaking for that group today. I'm here as a private citizen. I want to start with emphasizing something that Mary Fullwood said. We're not here to derail your process. We're here to keep it on track, to make sure it doesn't get derailed. I want to talk to you about three things today. The Coastal Commission letter, one of the firms that made your short list twice, and one of the firms that didn't make your short list. Obviously, the Coastal Commission letter emphasizes the fact that you cannot separate water reuse issues from the wastewater treatment project. Might want to do that, but you really, really can't. This is critical interest to the water purveyors, as this project must establish the framework for a successful adjudication in the groundwater basin. Agricultural exchange will be the key to that. That seems to be the only way we're going to reuse that much water efficiently. It's interesting that you'll quote NWRI regarding the water reuse issues, because it kind of agreed with you in trying to separate those issues. But you ignore the fact that they talked about how your consultants were gravity biased, which gets me to the firm that made your shortlist twice, Montgomery Watson Harza. Your own consultant, Carollo, described their Tri-W project as incomplete because they didn't have a good water reuse plan. We're heading back down that same track. Why do you want Montgomery Watson Harza involved again when they could not deliver a complete project over water reuse issues? Lyles should be on your shortlist. This is the STEP firm. They claim their proposal would be 20% cheaper than the fine screening estimates. Yesterday's viewpoint from your public works staff stated that STEP and gravity collection were co-equal environmental effect projects. The only way that can happen is if the collection systems are using the same kind of pipe. You have watertight pipe in high groundwater areas. Carollo said that would add 20% to the cost of the gravity system. Is that accounted for in the, I mean, are you committing to that 20% higher gravity estimate? And has that been factored in here? Innovation is the one thing that the Lyles team would bring. Innovation is something your staff has not shown. They say that you can't use a STEP system because of the need for easements on private properties. Why not put the tanks in the public rights of way where you have the room? The easements can come from the county. You could have a community collection tank. We have two of those out in Los Osos now, Vista, the Bay Ridge and Vista de Oro. Gravity fed to a STEP tank and then treat outside of town. The 2006 update that Ripley did for us demonstrated that a project outside of town, a STEP system, would be 50% cheaper than the Tri-W project to operate. Your survey talked about 5-year pump-out requirements for step tanks. Where is that legal requirement? You biased the survey that way.
Thank you, Mr. Sassini.
Short list has to include
steps. Thank you. Ms. McPherson, followed by Lisa Schicker.
Good morning. This is Gail McPherson from Los Osos. I've been preoccupied quite a bit with the regional board's resolutions to update the on-site regulations. And, you know, the Central Coast covers about a 300-mile long coastal zone. And with all of the things on Los Osos, I do have to say that part of the reason that they're updating these has to do with this county. This county, they believe, created the problem in Los Osos, allowed homes to be built in Los Osos, didn't build a treatment plant for years and years. But like a former supervisor said, there's plenty of blame to go around. For those who haven't followed closely the regional board's two on-site amendments to the basin plan, they're not a done deal. Both of those resolutions create new criteria, new requirements, and enforcement ability and authority. And I would like to just tell people of the county, as well as the elected that represent them, that there's a lot of information at the Citizens for Clean Water website, and an on-site dischargers group is forming in the entire region to address this, and we would really like the elected to stand with us as we move forward in opposing these regulations. This is a backdoor AB 885, and it will probably happen in other regions as well. I did want to note that Carol Maurer and Mary Fullwood, I'd like to incorporate by reference those comments rather than repeating some of those issues. They did a very good job of covering that. I hope they'll turn in written comments on what they said today. I think they were very succinct. I'm well versed in wastewater. I spent over 25 years in an executive level in wastewater as well as with a shovel. So I really know this stuff. And I also have a degree in marketing that I finished in 2004, by the way. So I have concerns about the survey, which I will address next week. But just to tell you, I think that the format was wrong. It should have been probably a conjoint. And I also have some experts that have looked over the survey and really agree that this is not the right format to do anything other than to inform and to create a decision in a profile on some people. Bottom line is, well, there's so many different issues here. There is a conflict, I think, with Montgomery Watson, perhaps, because they do design build in partnership with Montgomery Watson and Corolla. They have that on their websites. So I would like you guys to just look into the wisdom in picking a design firm that may cause risk and may derail the project. I just think it's unwise. There were 5 qualified teams. Perhaps you ought to take another look. And I also hope that STEP is going to be part of the process. And I look forward to next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McPherson. My last request to speak, Lisa Schicker.
Good morning. My name is Lisa Schicker. I was elected to the LOCSD board from 2004 to 2008. I have intimate knowledge of all the goings on with the wastewater project that was changed at that time. And I have important information about the firm Montgomery Watson Parsa. I encourage your board to take advantage of that knowledge and contact me. If you need more information, please do not make any decisions about Montgomery Watson Parsa unless you talk to me or Director Cecinia, who were there when all the things went down with Montgomery Watson Parsa, including the robbery, including, I won't go into details now, but I just encourage you to call me. I want you to know straight out, I care deeply about clean water. I want a project. We're here today instead of next week because you have a week to do your homework and your research to find out why we were here today. We're here today because we want you very much to reconsider the two things. The first is please include some kind of step analysis in the final outcome. Do not, you have that ability to override your staff. They write it up in their staff report. Please do this. That's the only way that the community of Los Osos is going to get the full process. Echoing Carol Maurer, Mary Fullwood, Richard Margetson, Chuck Cecinia, all of them said the same thing. Secondly, including Montgomery Watson Parsa with the clouded history that's still unsettled, they're still in bankruptcy with us at the LOCSD, it creates a huge kink in the trust. the trust level. We don't know why in the world you would have selected them. You may have good reasons, but you aren't sharing them with us yet. It seems so bizarre to us who were involved with this firm and what went on that we cannot fathom why you would be picking them. So please either disclose or look into it or something. Something's fishy with that. And then finally, I wanted to say I really encourage you to encourage your staff when they're writing editorials in the paper to not exaggerate, not twist, and not use facts that aren't true. Because once they do that, once they give one little fact that isn't true, they disqualify their comments because these people are very informed and they're paying attention. So once you use an exaggeration or an untruth, the whole piece gets discredited. And so that happened again with the public editorials, and I encourage you to look into that because we want this process to be positive. We want it to go forward, and that's why we're here. That's why we took time off again to be here. Finally, I talk to people in town all the time. They still ask me what's going on. A lot of people, the regular working people, had no idea what that survey was about. They didn't know what to do. They throw up their hands. They do express what Carol Maurer said. They express agony. They're very afraid. They don't know what's happening. They don't understand the process yet. I don't know how you can improve that, but I encourage you to do so. Thank you.
Ms. Schicker, that concludes public comment. Items not on our agenda. So we'll move on to our board business for the day. And Madam Clerk, if you would, let us know what's up.
What's up? This is going to be short and sweet. It's A1 Fiscal Year 2009-10 County Budget Update.
I was going to risk doing it myself, but I always think it better to leave it to the professionals. Speaking of which, Mr. Edge.
Very smooth, Mr. Chairman. Diane, you want to pop up? Thank you. No, not me. I looked up and saw myself. That was pretty scary. Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we're going to run through a summary of where we're at here. I'll do the big picture item, perhaps more for the viewing public than for the board members who will be familiar with the detail that we present. And then Gail will get into a little more detail on some of the items you'd asked to consider today in relation to salary and benefit costs and how that plays into the total picture. Please feel free during the presentation to stop and stop me and ask any questions that surface. Mine will be fairly brief, and we anticipate the overall staff presentation will be rather brief, leaving it really for discussion amongst the board. To remind you and share with the public, we are close to what Dan Buckshaw would describe as locking down the proposed budget. We plan on having that locked in a couple of days and in preparation for putting the CAO recommendations together and publishing the proposed budget. We anticipate there may be quite a lot of supplemental document changes between now and your June budget hearings, particularly as we wait to see what we all as voters decide to do in May and the various propositions that are on the state ballot for May. So quickly, this we'll focus on the general fund. That's where our bottom line challenge lies, in as much as money from the general fund flows into other funds. Those other funds with their own problems are dependent and variable on what the general fund does. This page really puts it together in I think the simplest way possible for people to understand. As you know well, we have literally hundreds of revenue line items and hundreds of expense items wrapped into the budget. But you can really express the challenge that you're facing in this particular way. By state law, you are required to equalize what's coming in with what's going out in any fiscal year. You can't operate at a deficit. On the right-hand column, you see status quo request in parentheses. What status quo means, you will recall, is that amount of expenditure that we believe is necessary for the departments to do the same things next year that they did this year. In other words, it takes this year's expense and increases it by any COLAs or inflationary costs or changes in departmental revenue that net out that we see coming. And you see there the bottom line that the status quo request nets out at $405 million, or totals out, I should say, at $405 million. And we anticipate that you have around $375 million coming in on the revenue side, hence the $30 million problem. Now, people will say, when they look at these numbers, well, okay, $30 million out of a $400 million budget is a belt-tightening issue. It's a problem, we can recognize that, but it's not a huge deal. It's about 8%. It means you have to trim your budget by 8%. Nobody wants to do it, but what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is this, as your board knows well, the $30 million that you have to trim doesn't actually come from that $405 million, because if you bounce over to the left-hand side of the column, you'll see the money and where it comes from. Departmental revenue is money that you can't trim to address the $30 million problem, because by definition, if an expense is cut that is supported by departmental revenue, then the departmental revenue generally drops by an equal amount. So effectively, what you're talking about is needing to cut $30 million from what we call the general fund bottom line of the departments, and that is the fund balance and non-departmental revenue supported line. So essentially, you're cutting $30 million from around $164 million. Hence, it's a significantly larger hit. It's approaching 20% versus the 8%. If you don't address the status quo, this is a chart we showed you, I believe, in October, and at that time, we anticipated the status quo gap. You'll see the starting point there at around $21.5 million. It's since grown as essentially the revenue side has deteriorated further. It's now grown to approximately $30 million. But this chart is still relevant, particularly for the public as they view your challenge. In the growth that you see there, as we look at trends we anticipate looking forward, moving into the next 5 years, you'll see that if you didn't tackle the status quo, if you didn't change the status quo expenditure level, that gap that you're having to deal with more than triples in that 5 year period. That's the problem that we have to address. You have to get those lines matching in some way. Both short-term and long-term dynamics come into play on that. Interestingly enough, the economic assumptions that we talked about in October when we first provided this chart to you seem to be playing out with the various economic forecasts that we're seeing recently from the professionals. Most recently, the UCLA Anderson forecast, which is a highly regarded forecast out of the University of California down there in LA, reflects almost precisely what we were looking at. The Anderson folk talk about a jobless economic recovery, that's their term, moving into 2010. Essentially, they say they anticipate the economy continuing to deteriorate through the rest of 2009, with unemployment rates peaking at the national level at close to 11%, and California moving up towards 12% before it bottoms out. They think that the housing price correction has almost fully reached its bottom line. We hope that's right. But that they don't think home prices will show any uptick until at least 2011. Well, essentially, when you look at their numbers, what they're talking about is for fiscal years that we will see some improvement in 2012-13, but that the housing market the improvement there we'll see in those years in property transfer tax and supplemental numbers as the market starts to move again. But because, as you know, we take an assessed valuation measure on January the 1st of each year for the upcoming fiscal year, the improvement in the basic property tax is not going to be seen until the subsequent fiscal year. Hence the numbers. And again, take the Anderson forecast for what it's worth. As you've heard, people who do economic forecasts are saying that the current situation doesn't seem to fit any of their historical models, so Anderson may be wrong, for better or worse.
And I don't know if this is your next topic, but are you going to discuss your assumptions on the top line there, the expense line?
Assumptions on the top line have built into them a somewhat reduced annual COLA. We anticipate that the marketplace, which prevailing wage has a survey, is going to reflect slowing numbers in COLAs. As you know, a number of counties have multi-year contracts that may include raises or may include automatic increases to cover the cost of health insurance increases, and each of those gets translated into a COLA cost, which we average out to produce whatever the prevailing wage number we end up with. And Gail will be speaking and showing you a chart of those prevailing wage numbers that are quite significant over the past few years. We think that'll slow. We have built in there a significant bump in a couple of years when you have a jail expansion and a juvenile hall expansion coming online. The cost of the county share of cost for those projects, frankly, is not the big deal because that's one-time money. The additional ongoing cost of required staffing increases are what's significant. We think that between the two projects, you're probably looking at around $2.5 million a year in additional staffing costs when they're fully up and operating. So those assumptions are built in, and I'll talk a little bit about the relatively flat revenue assumptions on the next slide. I want to talk about, as I said, we tried to make this on the front slide as simple as possible for people to understand the dynamic challenge that you have as a board in balancing the budget. The departmental revenue, remember I touched on that, around $211 million, out of that departmental revenue, you can really divide it into these two pieces. About three-quarters of it, 75%, comes in the form of state or federal subventions, basically money that is sent down to us from the higher levels of government, essentially, or for the most part, to carry out mandated functions, the big chunk of that money being in welfare and health programs. You, as a board, have very little control over the costs of those particular programs. You cannot, for example, say, we'll give this much money to a CalWORKs recipient as a grant, nor can you say, these are the criteria for which you would qualify for that kind of grant. Those criteria and that amount of money is set from the state and or the federal government. So that's the biggest chunk of your departmental revenue. Fees, charges, other, that's everything else, $55 million. The $55 million you expect you can control. So essentially, if your cost of service goes up, you can increase your fees to cover that cost of service. The problem with this dynamic is, as we know, state and federal budgets are running unprecedented deficits, and certainly we don't anticipate that changing anytime in the near future. The bottom line of that is we don't believe, when we look at revenue out years, that the state and federal subvention number, realistically, you can have any expectation of it increasing significantly. Back in October, I pitched a number that you see in that previous chart of about a net 2% per year increase in that subvention. I think right now that's an extremely optimistic view. I think it's probably more realistic to say you should expect a zero net increase in that number over the next 5 years. But we'll remain optimistic for now.
Net of inflation, or just
net, the number will not increase. I mean 2% flat, right. Period. On the non-departmental revenue side, that's the $149 million. Again, what you see here is that over the years, property tax, I put property tax plus, that includes things like property transfer tax and other property tax related revenues. You see that they have become the dominating individual revenue. There are about 45 or 50 individual line items in this particular category, but you see there property tax plus 86% of the total number, with sales tax and transient occupancy tax being your only other two big numbers, and then everything else totals around 8.4. Similarly to the issue with state tax, we've talked about what's the property tax number going to do. And if people like the Anderson forecast are correct, we anticipate little movement in that number in terms of growth over the next 3 years at least. We're looking at it being pretty flat going into 9-10. Maybe we would hope minimal growth for the next couple of years after that before in 12-13 or 13-14 we get back to normal, quote-unquote. And in this case, normal, nobody expects to be reflective of the kind of large double-digit increases we saw over the past decade. Realistically, normal in our county is probably in the mid to high single digits, say 7-9% per year. We'll be real happy when we get there, but it isn't coming for a while. So that's the bottom line on the revenue side. You just cannot anticipate significant increases in either departmental revenue or non-departmental revenue for at least the next 2 to 3 years, if then. So that's interesting. I've lost a... there you go. That was exciting. Where the money goes, this is a... I'm going to show you two slides. Again, the intent of these slides is to share the dynamic challenge that the board faces in making decisions. This is looking at the total general fund budget and where the money goes in the various areas of expenditure that you have. The significant things here, health and human services and public protection. You see there that in the overall budget, health and human services is your largest single area of expenditure. About 50%, again, higher than public protection, which is your next largest piece. The significant fact, as we touched on, is health and human services is largely underwritten by the federal and state government. And the next chart shows you how that changes when we get to the bottom line, where the local money goes. This is the money, around $164 million, that we spend, from which you have to find whatever cuts you're going to make. And you see the hugely significant change there. Public protection coming in at 44% of that money. So the challenge, the concept here is when you're talking taking $30 million out of a pot of around 160, the ability to not hit public protection to some extent is really not feasible. That you to take $30 million from what's left is would cause cuts that would simply be impractical in many respects. So the bottom line, as your board knows, while recognizing that you have expressed, as virtually every board in the state would do, that public protection is your locus is your local highest priority after you've dealt with state mandates, you're still not in a financial position to protect their status quo need, in our opinion. And we are presenting a budget that favors public protection, but again, requires some reduction from their status quo. Second piece, where the local money goes. Almost two-thirds of our expenditure goes into salary and benefit costs. We are a labor-intensive business. And similarly, part of the discussion, when you are talking about cutting close to 20% of your expenditure, you cannot do it practically by tackling just the non-salary side of the pie. It requires elimination of positions, whether that be by layoff or attrition is up for debate, and we'll be talking about ways to mitigate that. You have asked us to explore ways to mitigate it. We'll talk about that more, but certainly there'll be a significant number of positions that need to be eliminated from the workforce over a period of time to balance the budget. So this is what it comes down to. You've seen this slide before. I think, how do you slice the pizza? Right now, you're given a set size of pizza. You don't get to increase the size of pizza, at least in the short term. So it's a question of how you slice it up, and every mouth at the table waiting for a piece of pizza has a very good claim to a piece. And so the question is, do you try to feed all the mouths at the table by reducing everybody's size and portion a little bit? Or do you turn people away from the table and say, we can't afford to feed you? And it's perhaps a mix and match of both that you ultimately have to wrestle with. But it's not a fun question to have to deal with, because every dollar that you have to reduce means something in terms of important service that your organization provides to the community. How do you slice the pizza? Well, first you do it, as we've talked about, by beginning with the end in mind, because you and your predecessors have been financially prudent over the past few decades. We have one-time money, what we refer to as one-time money, set aside. You have some reserves, you have some contingencies set aside. You don't have to bite off the entire problem, as some of your colleagues will have to do around the state in the upcoming fiscal year. What we've settled on in general terms is tackling around two-thirds of the shortfall in 9-10 through operating reductions and using a variety of one-time monies to underwrite approximately $10 million. We'll fine-tune that, as Gail will talk about shortly. This year, you have to. That doesn't go away. That doesn't solve the problem, as you know. You still have to tackle the problem of that extra $10 million plus changes going down. This chart, as you see, assumes that we get back to normal, again in quotation marks, by the 2012-13 fiscal year. That's a hypothetical. This chart is purely hypothetical. It gives you a sense of the challenge as we see it. We think that that timeline, as I mentioned with the Anderson forecast and other economic forecasts, seems to be realistic. What it essentially means is that 9-10, currently difficult year, 10-11 will be at least as difficult a year, potentially more difficult, because the cuts that you have to make in 10-11 will compound onto the cuts that you have to make this year. Again, the basic plan here is you use one-time money in a prudent, planned fashion, gradually reducing the amount of one-time money you have to take out so that you, in this case, you zero out 4 years down the road. By its nature, as your board well knows, one-time money, you use it, it's gone, you don't get to use it again, so you're gradually drawing down those reserves. The variables that you have to deal with: revenue possibilities, we have talked about. This would be, the auditor has outlined for you a number of legal options you have for raising revenues. Any of the significant ones require voter approval. General purposes are 50% plus one, special purpose, two-thirds plus one. We think that the revenue possibilities realistically are off the table right now, preempted by the state's move that go into effect tomorrow to increase sales tax. Sales tax is one of those options you have. Sales tax goes up locally to 8.25 through 8.75 effective tomorrow. VLF, as you know, goes up almost doubles tomorrow to 1.15. So we don't think that you'll get a receptive audience for a significant tax increase anytime soon. Transient occupancy tax is the only one we think is perhaps politically realistic in at least the next election, by which I mean the 2010 election, because it doesn't impact local people, and you have a reasonable argument that you're looking to increase the county TOT to match that of the local cities. Again, it requires a vote of the people, 50% plus one, to pass. Expense drivers we'll touch on in a moment in more detail. They are there. Legal mandates, one of your variables, you and match it, or rolling into the next comment of overmatch, you're significantly overmatched in a number of legal mandate areas. What that means is you have a certain maintenance of effort requirements in areas like health and social services and public protection, for that matter. In a number of those over the years, you have chosen to add additional money to that base amount of local money required as a mandate match. And so you have some opportunity there, most notably in the health department. But again, each of those pieces of overmatch is a real program that provides services to real people. And then you have what I refer to in quotation marks as political mandates, perhaps more formally put as constituent priorities, and clearly there, as we all know, public protection is a high priority. and to the extent that you want to avoid cutting in that area, that generates a bigger cut because of the tyranny of numbers. The biggest piece of the money you can cut is spent in what is perhaps your constituent's highest priority, and that's a challenge for you. We have some short-term help that I mentioned, and we'll get into in more detail when Gail takes over. Towards the bottom of this list, it's not an exhaustive list, but it talks about the things that we have on the table. Use of reserves, I touched on my drawdown chart. We have some reserves. You can tap into them. They're one time. When you use them, they are gone. Federal stimulus money, a lot of conversation going on about this, and it's still a moving target. We have built some stimulus money that we have confirmed into the budget right now, approximately $1 million into the social services budget, around $500,000 right now into health. And we anticipate building some more into the sheriff's budget to avoid the question for you of laying off potentially 3 deputy sheriffs if we assume we get the same money. We don't know that yet because that's grant money as opposed to the numbers in social services and health that are formula provided amounts of money. Again, with federal stimulus money, the important thing for everybody to bear in mind is it is one-time money. It may be spread in programs over 1, 2, or in some cases 3 years, but it's still money that is scheduled to end at a date certain. Third item is reducing contingency. You carry a contingency in the general fund of 5%, and we've talked about and anticipate our budget will reflect perhaps a 4% contingency. 1% runs around $4 million, a little bit less. So that's a quote relatively easy cut in the first place, or in the initial calculation. Unpaid leave, we have debated a lot. We have quite a bit of voluntary time off built into, or we anticipate will be built into, the recommended budget. Mandatory time off, sometimes referred to as furlough, or things that the state did, is an option. We feel that mandatory time off nets out with voluntary time off. In other words, if you've got people that are volunteering to take, say, 6 days of voluntary time off, if we impose 2 days of mandatory time off, they'll only want to take 4 days of voluntary time off, and so it really nets out to zero impact in that effect. In addition, if we do specific furlough days, there are a lot of expense areas in our budget that one cannot practically close down that operation for a day, the big areas being, as you know, the jail and juvenile hall, along with court-related operations. So the impact of a furlough day for us is, in terms of dollar savings, is significantly lessened compared to the gross salary and benefit amount. Our wage freeze is a possibility, segues right into the final item of union negotiations. We are meeting, conferring with the unions right now at your direction over ways to reduce salary costs, both in the short term and longer term mode, and Gail will be detailing those shortly.
Mr. Edge?
Yes, sir.
Supervisor Hill had a question on this slide.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, on slide 11, on the plan to use the reserves over the 3-year period, what would that leave us in terms, for instance, if we get all the way down to the 12-13, we don't need to use reserves anymore, where are we at in terms of reserves that we will have, and is there a sense of how to build them back up?
Let me answer the second part first. The building back up would be a function of your board or your successors after, in this hypothetical case, the 12-13 fiscal year. My assessment of all the forecasts I read is that you're not going to be flush with money any time soon after 12-13. And so you're going to struggle, I think, and your successors potentially are going to struggle with building those reserves back up. If you get down as part of this, we're talking in this chart hypothetically of 21 mil. If part of that 21 mil is, say, reducing your contingency from 5% to 3%. It's about $8 million of that 21. How soon can you build back up to 5%? Is that how soon do you or your successors feel you have a $4 million per percent that you can afford to not put into operating expense? I just don't have a good answer of that. It's going to be a function of what the revenue stream expense demand looks like 13, 14, 14, 15 and onwards. There are things like contingency that it's not vital to immediately build back up. It's prudent to try to do it as soon as possible, but it's not something you have to immediately build back up. To the extent that we're using one-time money that is not making contributions to depreciation accounts for things like buildings or automation equipment, that becomes more pressing. You have an accumulated amount of money, for example, to buy replacement automation equipment. If you fail to do the actuarially calculated necessary amounts of contribution for depreciation purposes within a few years, you essentially use up the money you've set aside, and then to the extent you need to replace a computer, you have to tap your ongoing operational expenses to do it. So going to your first question, how much is left? It's a little bit like asking how long is the piece of string we have, and I'm going to turn around and ask Dan to help me because I never quite remember the number. We've got around $34 million of reasonably accessible reserves.
Yeah, of that, about $30 million is earmarked for various projects, about $5 million is truly un-earmarked available.
Yeah, oh, that's good. We have some ability to take money from roads. So if $21 million was what you expended, I guess we would say from a staff level, that wouldn't be imprudent, but it would leave you with lesser. For example, we have a tax reduction reserve of around $5 million that this plan would probably reduce to zero, but that's that was a reserve that conceptually was set aside to deal with exactly this kind of an issue. We wouldn't anticipate, for example, this would require you to tap your $8 million reserve for emergencies, nor would it require you to take money out of capital project money you have set aside for your jail match, your juvenile hall match. But clearly, it would net out, again, hypothetically, this would leave you $21 million less in reserves minus whatever you took out of contingency. So if it was 21, you took out $8 million from contingency, you'd have about $13 million less in reserve than you currently have.
Mr. Meacham, do you want to follow on here?
Well, just thank you. It's kind of scary how parallel we're thinking here. That was exactly the route I was going. But in terms of the reduction of contingency relative to use of reserves over the time frame, they definitely intermix. So whatever determination we make with, for example, the contingencies has a direct reflection on the reserves over time. Is that correct?
It's got an indirect reflection, I guess the best way to put it. To the extent that you have money left over, quote-unquote, fund balance available at the end of the year, what we have done in the past, what your board has often done in the past, is if we have planned and built into the budget a $15 million reserve, and at close of books, the auditor says, you have $5 million of, when we close the book, you have $5 million extra, then your board and your predecessors have traditionally put that money, or most of that money, into the various reserves account. That's how you've built up things like tax reduction reserve over the years. To the extent that you have smaller contingencies and tighter revenue and expenditure forecasts, it's less likely you have money beyond the fund balance available projection, hence less ability to put money into reserves thereafter.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Carry on.
I'm getting close to wrapping my piece of it. So those are variables we talked about. Short-term help I talked about. The continuing challenges, this is my last slide before Gail takes over. I touched on some of this a little bit. Revenue options. As I talked about in terms of state and federal subvention, federal budget deficit, trillions of dollars, unlikely to change in the foreseeable future, and clearly puts enormous pressure
on those significant dollars coming down from the federal government to our health and welfare programs, therefore unlikely to see a significant ongoing increase in that. Similarly, state budget, their deficit and their tax increases, I think the tax increases pretty much preempt your ability to raise local taxes, and the budget deficit, currently millions and billions are all together these days. If the lottery proposition fails, that adds an additional $5 billion to the current deficit. Chances are the $8 billion, if it's $8 billion now, it'll be $10 billion by summer. So the state, unlikely on this particular analysis to be giving us more money. Much more likely they're going to be giving us less money. We know that the federal stimulus calculation by the state that was deadlined for tomorrow, they've already made it. The treasurer and the director of the Department of Finance both agree that the state will not meet the trigger amount. That means that a number of cuts, primarily in the social services area, will go into effect. The trigger said if we do not as a state get $10 billion of federal stimulus money in certain specified programs, then this list of cuts will automatically take effect. The biggest personal impact for members of the public is that the income tax surcharge will remain at 0.25% and will not drop down to 0.125%. It will mean for those people that receive things like SSI, SSP payments that they won't get the COLA that they'd otherwise be entitled to. It means that people receiving CalWORKs grants will get, I believe, a 4% cut in those grants. None of those trigger items affect our bottom line in terms of the $30 million problem that you're dealing with, but obviously they affect some of those people that are enrolled in those programs that I mentioned that, you know, one sometimes says is our most vulnerable population. So there's going to be challenges there. The Ledge Analyst Office refers to an anemic recovery over 5 years, kind of reflects the language that the Anderson School folk are doing. So we don't see the revenues booming up. And, of course, the bottom line is voter approval is needed for any local increase that you're interested in doing anyway. On the expense side, we sometimes refer, and it's a degree of gallows humor, people say, but it's actually fairly accurate. We are, every county in the state is, by state statute, focused on what we refer to as the human misery business. What we mean by that is that our primary mandate mission is to provide state services at a regional level in the indigent healthcare and welfare program arena, and also in the public protection business, not patrolling police officers per se, but jail, juvenile hall, probation, prosecution, and indigent defense. And hence we categorize those as the human misery business. And that's a business that unfortunately tends to increase in economically bad times. Jail juvenile hall expansion I referenced earlier. We see those coming online within a couple of budgets. And once that staff is fully engaged, it'll be probably around $2.5 million of additional annual cost. Prevailing wage and COLA costs have been significant expense drivers. Gail will touch on those in the next slide. As have been pension costs. You're all well aware of that. And a lot of that is built into the nature of the marketplace in which we attract and retain individuals. When people talk about, well, if we eliminated prevailing wage, got a voter initiative to eliminate prevailing wage ordinance, would that solve our problems? The answer is no, it wouldn't. It would give you as a board a little more flexibility in what you could do on a year-to-year basis, but essentially your board, like every other public sector agency governing body, has to pay in the long term whatever the California public sector marketplace says a job is worth, both salary and benefits, whether that job be a custodian or a deputy sheriff or a CAO or a planner or whatever it may be. You don't get to make those decisions as the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors in isolation from what the rest of the state is doing. So while prevailing wage, if eliminated, gives you a little more flexibility to, say, freeze a COLA in a given year, it certainly doesn't change the basic dynamic, which is what the marketplace for public sector employees says our jobs are worth, for better or worse. So with that, I'll hand the magic button over to Gail, and you know, feel free again to ask any questions before we bounce into.
All right. In the transition, any questions for Mr. Edge? First, second, I think we're going to take a short break here to process what we've heard. And
before we get on to the fun stuff.
Before we get on to Ms. Wilcox's presentation, so I would suggest we reconvene in 10 minutes, 10:35, please. Yeah. Okay, very good. All right, we'll...
David, at one point we'd asked to have a summary of all of those, you know, with a description maybe of what we're going for. Well, that's good.
Closed session, we have somewhere between 1 and 2 hours of talk, so I don't know how you want to...
Okay. We didn't schedule afternoon public comment, so I'm going to say we will go by your estimate. We will be back here when we're done and would accept public comment. Just to clarify, we'll accept public comment at that point. The other question that we have, and we'll get going here, is about how many soups can attend a RAC meeting, the Roof Water Resources.
Well, it depends on what you do.
Yeah, so maybe we can talk about that in quickly in closed session. Madam Clerk, we heat it up. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, let's go ahead and reconvene our morning session. I apologize for the slight delay in getting going, but we were marking Supervisor Hill's birthday, which occurred a couple days ago, and it occurs to me, I don't think I'll stand to be corrected here, but we were noting Supervisor Hill is the first San Luis Obispo County Supervisor born in the 60s. So not getting any more specific than that, we'll turn it over to Mr. Edge.
Someone who wasn't born in the 60s. very quickly, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to give you a little more detail on reserves. People had a couple of board members had asked about. You have available in round figures $80 million in various reserves. Of that money, around $29 million is essentially inaccessible to you for any other purpose than this is things like traffic impact fees that you use for specific purposes, down to things like an amount of money set aside for the old Los Osos landfill closure. You can't take that money away and use it for other things. Of the amount you got left, again, in round figures, around $50 million, $5 million tax reduction reserve, not designated for anything that I talked about previously. And of the remaining money, around $46 million, these things like $8 million general reserve for emergencies. You have $6 million set aside for Willow Road as a designated reserve. Each of these has a specifically identified purpose that it's set aside for, but you could change that purpose. You have $2.4 million set aside for facilities planning. You have $6.5 million set aside for the detention facilities, jail and juvenile hall for the local match. You have $1 million set aside for fire equipment replacement. So those are monies that you and your predecessors have designated for specific uses, but you're not locked into having to use that money for that purpose. But obviously, implications, if you set aside $1 million for replacement fire trucks and you take it away, you need to replace a fire truck, you then have to take that out of it. So in terms of the hypothetical I presented to you, you're probably, if you were talking about $21 million in total and $8 million of that was from contingency, you'd be looking at tapping these reserves for around $13 million in total. And currently we have that up as a mix from buying down the tax reduction reserve, not making contributions to the facilities reserves and the automation reserves and tapping some of the roads pavement management money. And again, Gail might touch on that next. But on that, Mr. Chairman, at that point, we just wanted to give you that additional detail, and now we can hand it on to somebody else who was born in the 60s.
Actually, one more question, Supervisor Patterson.
Yes, Mr. Edge, just for point of clarification, any of the public facility fee monies that are set aside, they are part of that $29 million and are designated reserves and can only be used for the purposes for which they were collected.
You have certain impact fees that are set aside for public facilities, and they can only be used for those specific purposes. You also have, for example, the detention facility money. That was general money that you set aside, so you could theoretically take that and use it for something else.
Okay, and then that $50 million balance you mentioned, that does include contingency or does not?
That does not. Those are reserves, doesn't include contingency.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And contingency is roughly $20 million at 5%.
Right. So it'll be if you bring the budget down to around $375 million, obviously the contingency drops a little bit by formula as a starting point. So instead of saving $4 million per percent, you actually save $3.7 million per percent.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. With that, we'll turn it over to Ms. Wilcox.
Okay, thank you. Just picking up where David left off in terms of closing the $30 million gap, here's a breakdown of what you'll see presented in the proposed budget based on the direction provided by the board so far. The numbers are a little bit different than the 2010 scenario that David presented, simply because we have now wrapped in the economic stimulus money as well as the fund balance available that the auditor's office is now estimating is going to be about $1.4 million higher than we originally thought. So basically, the breakdown is about $8.5 million from one time, a combination of tapping into your reserves, reducing operating contingencies, deferring depreciation again this year, just as we did deferring depreciation again next year, just as we did in the current year, deferring maintenance, and then reducing the general fund contribution to roads. The expense reduction, about 18.5, again, as opposed to the $20 million. And that rolls us right into the next slide, which is when we look at reducing expenses, you know, salary and benefits represent 2/3 of our overall expenses, so obviously it's inevitable that when you're looking to significantly reduce expenses, you need to look at salary and benefits. I have an excerpt here from the prevailing wage, and I'll read you the whole thing, but whenever we start to talk about compensation for county employees, we need to start out by pointing out that we are operating under a voter-initiated prevailing wage ordinance that says you, as the Board of Supervisors, in setting compensation for county employees, shall provide a percentage change in compensation at least equal to the percentage change in compensation for the same quality of service rendered to persons, governmental agencies, firms, or corporations under similar employment. Then it goes on to say, this shall all be determined by negotiations. Now, clearly, that doesn't say that we have to compare ourselves with other counties, and it doesn't even say we have to compare ourselves with public agencies, but that's what we've historically done as a result of the negotiations with the various employee associations. The board had asked that we provide data about the growth in salary and benefit costs over the past few years, as well as options that we could use to reduce those costs, and so we're going to walk through some of the things that we've been talking to the employee associations about. Briefly, though, for 2009-10 salary and benefit costs, salary only for about 2,500 employees, about $170 million. And you go into the benefits, the retirement-related benefits alone add another $67 million. And the breakout is right below that, Social Security, the 10.3, Medicare, 2.5, post-employment health, that's retiree health costs. And then the last one, which is really the big one, the one that has swung us and, you know, it's a big part of the expense problem we're dealing with now. In two years ago, the county's pension contribution, how much we contributed every year to the pension trust, was $34 million. It's going to be $51 million next year. It's a significant increase, 50% increase, and it's not an exaggeration to say that this is a big part of the problem we're dealing with right now. continuing on, work comp, about $3 million, disability unemployment insurance, about $500,000, and then our medical, or we call it the cafeteria contribution, this is for active employees, about $23 million. The grand total of salary and benefits is about $264 million. You divide by that by the number of total employees we have, and that average compensation per county employee is $103,000 a year. This one's a little small, so I apologize, and there's, I think, back in the day, there was a belief that the public employee salaries were lower than the private sector and that benefits, on the other hand, were higher. We put together some data for you on salary increases since 2001 and adjusted that for inflation. And the classifications I have there are basically benchmark classifications. They're ones that we use to that drive the increases for other classifications. For example, the admin analyst 3 is a benchmark classification. And whatever salary increase or compensation increase is granted to the admin analyst 3 is also granted to about 70 other mid-management classifications. So it gives you an indication of salary increases that have been granted for county employees at all levels. So reading basically in 2001, the salary for admin analyst was about $55,000. If you adjusted that for inflation in 8-9, it would be about $66,500. What it actually is $79,452. So the point being that we've significantly outpaced inflation. It's just one indicator, and that's primarily because we have prevailing wage and we're doing what other counties are doing as opposed to adjusting for inflation. I'm going to skip that one.
Could I ask, and actually I have Supervisor Patterson's light still on.
That's a carryover.
Are there counties that do simply make adjustments based on cost of living indexes?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
Most counties negotiate them based on the financial situation, and whether it's a cost of living or this year we don't have any money and so it's zero this year or, you know, whatever it is, but yes.
Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gail, you said that the prevailing wage doesn't require us to do the comparable county formula.
Sorry. Thank you, Eric. You said that the prevailing wage ordinance doesn't require the comparable counties formula that we deploy. I wondered, I guess, two questions, one of which is when did we start doing that, and then the other question is why did we start doing that?
It predates even me, so a long, 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 long time ago. Why? It makes sense. It does make sense. The place that you're more likely to find people doing as close to what we're doing as county employees is other counties. And that's the driving argument of the employee associations. You certainly could apply that to cities as well for a number of our positions. If you wanted to compare with the private sector, in some cases there's no comparable. They don't have deputy sheriffs. They do have clerical and maintenance and those type folks, and so that could be an option to look at private sectors for certain classifications. But clearly, if we started using the private sector for some of our classifications, the compensation would drop considerably. And then there's the remaining point that sometimes getting data from the private sector, they have no obligation to provide us with that data, and so we wouldn't necessarily always be able to get relevant data.
I was actually going to amplify on the last point Gail mentioned, that from my understanding, I'm vaguely insulted by it, it was a long, 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 long time ago. Not quite sure why. From what I'm told, this county initially, in the very early years, did attempt to work with private company, local private company data, and had the challenge that Gail just alluded to of, as I think some of you know, in the private sector, actual salary data tends to be a very closely kept secret. I know some companies, you get fired if you tell your colleagues what your paycheck has in it. And so, again, this is, I'm told this, Santos, recently retired Santos Arona, around the time was telling me this a couple of years. He said that what they found was that after 1 or 2 years, it just wasn't practical to use that because they were unable to get consistent or full data from the local private sector to make it usable for the kind of formula negotiations we were getting into. So very early on, a little wrestling with could we use private sector, practically found out they couldn't. Shifted into the public sector very soon after the ordinance was adopted, and since then the negotiations have
have moved us to where we are with a particular set of counties versus cities or anything else.
And is this, if I could, Mr. Chair, is this common in other counties in terms of looking at the prevailing wage? It's either private sector comparisons or comparable counties?
I know very few. I know no counties that use private sector in any kind of systematic way. Some will reference it on occasion, but I know of none that use it in any systematic way. Most counties that I'm aware of comp to their colleagues. There are some that have formulas that work, notably in some police agencies. They'll comp with local cities, or in some case they'll comp with CHP. But again, the overwhelming process at this point seems to have gradually morphed into cities will comp to similarly sized and situated cities by and large, and counties will tend to comp to similarly situated counties. Just for ease of data gathering purposes. But again, no magical requirement to that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Wilcox.
To add to that, in the HR world, the people that you really should be comping yourself to are the people that you're competing with for your employees. And clearly, we're not competing with Marin County for our employees. An option is to look at the surrounding cities, at least for the classifications that we have that are similar, police officers compared with deputy sheriffs. So that's an option that we've talked in closed session about, as well as the mix of counties. There's been a fair amount of discussion about, for example, Marin County and whether or not Marin and San Luis Obispo are comparable, certainly not in housing costs. So we do have the ability to look at the mix of counties, there's no question. So there's some flexibility in there. So in terms of reducing, the board wanted us to talk a little bit about, well, what options do we have for reducing salary and benefit expenses? Clearly, eliminating positions, and that's what we're looking at as part of the proposed budget. Along with eliminating positions, you're looking at reducing service levels. Right now, although we haven't locked down the numbers, we won't for about another week. Another day. I don't want to upset Dan. We'll be locking down the numbers any minute now. About 150 positions that we're estimating we'll be eliminating. At this point, I can't tell you how many are filled, or we don't really want to talk about how many are filled at this point. We're in discussion with the employee associations about changes that they might be willing to make to mitigate the number of layoffs, the number of people who are actually be off the job. Other options that we talked about, and David references in his comments, furlough or MTO, those both were using them interchangeably. Furlough is the word that the state uses. We had previously used mandatory time off, and it's basically saying we're either going to close facilities X number of days during the year, 10 days during the year, we're going to close all non-essential facilities, can't close your jail, can't close your inpatient psych unit, et cetera. Or we could have a floating or bank of MTO days where employees are basically told during the year you have to take 10 unpaid days off. You work with your supervisor to figure out when that's going to be. It's the same thing as laying people off in terms of the reduction of service levels. It reduces the service levels and it reduces employees' pay, but it mitigates the number of layoffs. And the last bullet is not phrased very well, but the $600,000, David mentioned that we have, based on the department's budget submittals, we've included about $600,000 of general fund savings in the 9-10 proposed budget. Based upon what departments say, the employees have indicated we're willing to step up to the plate and do this many hours of voluntary time off. Voluntary time off obviously is different from mandatory time off in that it's at the employee's discretion. It's also advantageous for the employee because they continue to accrue time in service and retirement credits and vacation and sick leave. So it doesn't save nearly as much money for the county because we're paying for all those, especially the pension, but it does save the salary cost. However, a concern of ours in talking about going to mandatory time off is that it's very likely to change, at least to some extent, the number of employees who are willing to take voluntary time off on top of being furloughed, because then you're getting deeper into their paycheck. Here are the numbers for the past year. one option that we will be talking to the Employee Association about is rolling back some of the 8-9 compensation, the fiscal year 8-9 compensation increases, and here they are. And I know for a lot of folks in the private sector, these were kind of hard to swallow, but it's all based on the comp county data that came in. For our largest unit, SLCIA, they were 6-7%. Deputy Sheriff's Association got 7.6% compensation increase. Our DA investigators, 8.7%. We're still in negotiations with our attorneys. Our non-management probation got 7.8%. Probation management, 7%. Sheriff's management, 7.6%. And all your other general non-safety, miscellaneous management, department heads, mid-managers, and the Board of Supervisors got between 1.5% and 3%. Significant increases. A 1%, if everybody agreed to a 1% rollback in that salary, it's a gross savings of $2.4 million. We could also look at waiving compensation increases for 9-10. We don't know what that savings would be because we have not done the salaries, the compensation surveys for 9-10 yet. But clearly that would help significantly in reducing, in terms of mitigating the numbers of layoffs. And then reducing pension benefits. For existing employees, we could only do it if they agreed, and they, you know, you're not going to get all employees to agree to do that. Some might volunteer, but it's unrealistic to think that all employees would agree to roll back their pension benefits. So instead, we talk about new hires and what people refer to as second tier of pension benefits. And all that means is it's a different level of benefits for the new employees that are coming in. It's not an immediate savings. It's more right turning the ship around because, especially now we're not hiring all that, too many new employees. But it is a way of addressing down the line the impact that the pension benefits have had on the county budget.
Supervisor Meacham has a question, and I have a
thank
comment.
You, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Wilcox, in regard to the positions that are unfilled, we've discussed this a little bit, but I'm curious to see what my colleagues feel in this regard. In a lot of cases, the budget reflects unfilled positions. If we're in a situation now where we don't anticipate hiring anybody for a while and actually a reduction in staff, then why would we not adjust that budget so we have the hard numbers and not put those unfilled positions in there? And what would that dollar amount equate to?
Most of the positions that we're recommending for deletion are vacant. So those are going first. I think the vast majority of departments, when they put together their cut list, they have the vacant positions on there first. The exceptions are when the vacant positions are funded with, fee revenue or, like if a water systems worker, you're not going to get any general fund money savings by not filling that. But the ones that are vacant that are funded with general fund money are going away as part of the budget.
Okay, good. And I wonder if you could go back to the slide before the one I think you have up. If you go back two slides and go through this list in this slide and the next slide, it might be well to point out that we are under contract with our labor unions. Some of the categories on the next slide we have contracts with, some of them we don't. And it might be well to just point out those things that the board actually has the discretion to do. Unfortunately, the main lever that the board has to pull here, the main control it has, is on the matter of layoffs, and we certainly want to minimize those the best we can. The imposition of mandatory time off is something we have to negotiate because of contract.
That's true. Let me put the different units on here. For your probation and your Deputy Sheriff's Association, you are in the middle of a contract, and aside from eliminating positions and laying off people, you have very little ability. I mean, they don't have to agree to anything willingly. Certainly, we've asked them to voluntarily agree to it. They've not indicated thus far that they want to talk about any changes, but that would have to be voluntary on their part. 1,700 of your county employees are represented by SLCIA. 1,500 of them in what we call the big unit, supervisory, clerical, and public services. Their contract expires in 3 months, and we are actually should be starting negotiations any day now on a new contract. That leaves them in the position of, or us in the position of, you could impose all of these things.
Right. And I just wanted, I think the great benefit of this particular session is our ability to help educate the public, who I think absolutely needs to know these issues that we're trying to to reconcile. And you made mention early in your presentation about your approach to the bargaining units, to the union units that are under contract, and that we are asking them for flexibility because we have this very direct trade-off between what the individual compensation package is and how many individuals this county can employ. So it does absolutely have a very human effect here, as well as the question of how it affects residents of this county. So we're trying to see if we can be creative, trying to see if we can find ways in which we can absolutely minimize the number of actual filled positions that we have to lay off.
The employee associations could play a great, significant role in reducing the number of layoffs, absolutely, regardless of whether they're middle contract. Just the key, as you said, is that if they're in the middle of a contract, they don't have to if they don't want to.
And at the same time, we are bound by our prevailing wage ordinance. We can't, you know, among those who are not contracted in a contractual agreement with their employment in the county, we can't simply go in and decide that we're going to roll back time or any of that. So
even unrepresented management is still subject to the prevailing wage ordinance. So you can't just go in and say we're going to cut your pay.
Cut your salary. I mean, we can talk about mandatory
furlough
time.
Correct.
Supervisor Patterson?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to echo again that we have very little flexibility to change the terms of agreements that have already been entered into. And the one thing that we do have authority over is the actual position allocations and determining how many employees a given department has. And so given that, our effort has been to work with the departments to find other ways of reducing the cost of our employees other than actually reducing the number of employees. But Ms. Wilcox, one thing that I haven't seen mentioned that I think is on the table also, in order to reduce the number of layoffs, and you did mention that the vacant positions are basically factored into the current budget proposal, we still have some positions out there that are perhaps in need of reducing. We still have more reductions to make. And we've discussed incentives for people to perhaps retire early to create a vacant position so we can either move somebody into that position or avoid a layoff in some other way. But I didn't see you speak to that this morning. Is that something you're also discussing with the bargaining units?
Yes, and obviously we can't talk about specific proposals that we have with any of the bargaining units, but we are talking to all of them or have talked to all of them about a retirement incentive. The challenge there is that we don't know who would take the retirement incentive. And so if you had a situation where the people who ended up taking it were water system workers and engineers and people that not only would save you no general fund money, but we wouldn't leave that position vacant.
Right. If they're in critical positions, we just simply have to refill it.
So there may be not only little general fund savings, but no opportunities to put somebody else in there. For example, a water system worker, very, you know, the credentials that they have to have and certificates. And we don't know at this point. That's why we're just talking to Slesia about that. If we offer that up and it turns out that it's an option that the folks who select it, that we don't end up creating any vacancies really or saving any money, then, you know, where did that get us? So, but we are in discussion. We had a meeting with Slesia yesterday and a counter proposal that we'll be discussing in closed session today.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Supervisor Hill?
Yes, thank you. And I want to follow up on your comment about this.
Mike again.
Should we keep that
we
on?
Want to hear you, buddy.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You know, I have, since we're the public representatives for the county, I mean, we spend a lot of time talking to the public, and I've spent a fair number of discussions with people in the public about some of these budget issues. And even when the prevailing wage ordinance and some of these other things are explained, there still is, and I think it's important that department heads and the bargaining unit general managers hear this too. Because of the state of the overall economy, there's a fair amount of populist resentment out there, and people don't really care about the explanation. They just don't get it, why stores are closing and people are losing jobs and public sector employees are getting raises in the midst of this. They don't get that, even if you explain the mechanism, you explain the ordinance, and I think that that's
a big challenge. You know, that's part of, I guess, why we're trying to have a discussion of as much shared sacrifice and as many creative ways to approach this, but it's hard to overcome that sense that's out there right now, regardless of it. And I think that everybody needs to be aware of that. You know, that I think it will continue to be stoked too, is my sense as well. As long as the economy remains pretty volatile, it will be.
We continue to work creatively. We want a fair solution here, one that serves, you know, the needs of our constituents, who do expect certain levels of county service in a variety of different roles. You know, fair compensation for work done, and the necessity, the absolute necessity, in balancing our budget. So.
Just a follow-up comment,
yeah.
If I could. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that the key to a lot of what we're trying to accomplish is so that this doesn't incite, or as Mr. Hill mentioned, taking it out of the hands of those that have to make these decisions by going to an initiative of some sort. There's a lot of discussion out there. And rather than take it from that direction, we'd like to be able to work with that here, deal with ourselves, as opposed to a voter initiative that would take it completely out of our hands. So we need to be careful of how we deal with that as well.
Good point. Ms. Wilcox?
David Edge has been for years talking about, you know, a draconian measure such as that, and the need to make some changes, in particular in the pension benefits, because they are driving huge increases in every governmental agency across the state. When the pension benefits were enhanced, the promise, that the belief was that they would be paid for by all the increases in the income taxes, and, you know, everybody's doing so well in the stock market, and now that's all fallen apart. And we've already had significant pension rate increases. We're facing another one next year, as is PERS. It's going to get worse before it gets better in terms of how much our pension benefits cost us. There's no question about that. And then lastly, the board wanted to have a little discussion about, well, second-tier pension benefits, what could that look like? Not to oversimplify it, but a defined benefit program is what we and most public sector agencies have, our defined benefit, our pension program, and that basically means that the pension benefit amount is guaranteed. So I get 2% of the highest year salary for every year of service. If an employee retires and their single highest year of salary is $100,000 and they've worked 30 years, then they get $60,000 a year for the rest of their life, adjusted every year for up to 3% for inflation. There's no question that you're going to get that benefit. The risk is obviously on, well, mostly the employer, because when things happen like they're happening now, which is earnings are way down from what the assumption was they would be, and salary increases have been significantly higher for years than what the Pension Trust Board, and the Pension Trust Board is an independent board, does not get to influence in any way their decisions, but their assumption about salary increases was very low for many years in a row. And so the combination of expenses being higher and revenue being lower have contributed to the gap that required them to order a pension rate increase of 9% 2 years ago. So defined benefit program, we could have a second tier that is still a defined benefit program, but it's modified. It's not, and I will be glad to go into some of the details if you want, but basically it's less of a defined benefit than we have now. Instead of having it based on single highest year, maybe roll it back to the average of the 36 months. You can tinker with it to modify the defined benefit, make it more like it was 10 years ago for county employees, as opposed to the many enhancements that have been made in the past 10 years.
Ms. Wilcox, if I may, pension benefits for the year 2009-2010 is $21 million more than the $30 million gap that we have here today. So there is one area that has this large chunk of money that could have a large impact on our entire budget. You can keep everything status quo and still save money if we concentrate on the pension fund, which we do have legal obligations to offer, but those legal obligations, and I stand to be corrected, will go away if the agreement from the other side comes into the picture that they will look into it more favorably. In talking to Mr. Edge for a little while, he did mention, and that's where I need a little more information shared publicly, if you average 36 month versus 12 month. Can you educate us on that? Or maybe if I want to refer to Mr. Age.
Simply put, in your last 3 years of employment, you'll go up 5% a year, every year, say. And so if you average that, it's just your single highest year is generally when your last year when you're paid the most. But if you have it over a period of 36 months as opposed to the single highest year, in general, we estimate that the pension benefit would be about 5% less.
Obviously, if you're at an age where you're looking for retirement, this is a real issue. If you're coming in, you have entire life ahead of you. As we speak here, I just want to plant a seed to hear from those who are towards retirement to take this opportunity, knowing that there's a bug going in my head to respond to those needs. I'd like to hear from them at one time or the other. As how would they feel if this was to take a different direction than business as usual as far as the pension fund goes?
Are you asking about whether employees could or would agree to make changes to their... My understanding, and Warren can weigh in here, is it's not even a matter of by bargaining unit, that it would have to be every single employee agreeing to do that because it's a vested benefit. Warren, is that...
Yes, those benefits, once offered, when people rely on those by continuing to work pursuant to those benefits become a vested right and could only be changed or ratcheted down if everyone agreed to do that.
And it seems like from everything else I'm hearing here that pension fund on its own is what's breaking us.
It's a significant contributor, absolutely.
Thank you.
So defined contribution is the other side of a defined benefit. It limits your risk. It's a known liability because the amount of money you contribute as an employer is defined. You know in advance. It's basically a 401k. And the employer says, although in the public sector it would be a 457, and the county would say, we're going to contribute this amount, usually it's a percentage of your salary, into a 457, and then you get whatever the earnings you achieve through whatever your investment vehicles are. There's no risk to the county or to the employer other than the known commitment and match, if you will. And the hybrid has been talked about a lot in the last few years. A number of counties are looking at or have implemented. Hybrid is basically a combination of defined benefit and defined contribution. An example is Kern County. They implemented a defined benefit of 1.6% at 65, plus the county matches the employee's contribution to a 457 plan up to 6% of their salary. So it just is a combination. It limits the risk a little bit more for the county, but there's still some risk because it is part defined benefit. And we have reopeners with SOCIA to discuss the second tier. We've talked to all the bargaining units. Again, the ones that are mid-contract are not interested in talking about it right now. But and again, I also need to say this is about savings over a long term. There's no immediate savings here. It's about turning the ship around. And I think that if most people could go back 10 years, the changes that were made to our public sector pension benefits probably would not have been made, but that's water under the bridge. So this is what we're trying to do, is turn the ship around.
Thank you. Supervisor Meacham?
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wilcox. And I think that the last point is something that really needs to be hammered home, is we need to make some adjustments for the future to make sure this county is secure down the road. But a question in regard to negotiation, who are we negotiating with? Because these are for new hires, and there aren't any. So I guess I'm not clear as who's going to be saying, yes, this is a good idea or a bad idea. The final determination, I would assume, comes to this board.
Well, certainly in case of when we're open with SOCIA, all of them, you could impose any of it. But to the extent that it's a change in terms and conditions of employment, and it's a good question, the way the Employees Association feel, and Kim Daniels is here and she can certainly speak to it, and she is there, they feel pretty strongly against the idea of a second tier, and they're not alone. It's something that I hear when I go to other counties as well. The idea that you're going to have two employees in the same classification who have maybe very different pension benefits, and that creates ill will between those employees, and then secondarily that you have difficulty recruiting employees if we have a lesser pension benefits. And this is exactly the argument that employee associations, that's how they've been so effective in getting elected officials to enhance benefits, is because they say, everybody else is doing it. If we don't do it, then we won't be able to recruit and retain qualified employees. And then it just keeps jumping up and jumping up. Personally, I think the state of California and every governmental agency should have one of two pension systems, one for miscellaneous and one for public safety, so that they don't have all you elected officials jumping around trying to keep up with the next jurisdiction.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Mr. Sargent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a puzzle that we always want to be better, and I want our folks to do better, just like if my own kids were getting jobs. But the circumstances needs to come into the picture as we move forward. We always want to pay better. One of the reasons that we don't want to lose the good health to another agency that's paying better. But today's circumstances is such that to have a job is a good news, or to be able to hold on your job is even a better news. But if we're not careful and we maintain the same mentality, then a lot of us won't be here, and that's real sad. It's not easy, even if we look at numbers, and regardless if it's 150 or 15, but once we start putting pictures with the, as who's getting laid off, and the domino effect that that's going to have on families, possibilities of more foreclosure, possibilities of more homelessness, and it just worsened the case. But if we're not all coming together to say, this is what it is, and this is the only way to address it, at least for the next fiscal year, at least for the next three years, then it's somebody going to get hurt more than they have to. I just hope that the message to whatever side that it needs to go to, we have to go deal with the bottom line. We have no choice. So let's take these sides away and become all of us in the same, get on the same boat and see how we all going to help each other to simply because there's a circumstances, if ignored, it's worse than otherwise. We can all bite the bullet for the next 3 years and carry through and help each other out and make this even a better county, and forget that we might lose somebody for another jurisdiction because they're probably in a worse case than we are. And that mentality has to change.
Thank you. Mr. Meacham.
Okay, clear that. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think part of the problem, and Ms. Wilcox, when you're negotiating here, I don't know that we can actually make these changes until we do have open contracts and we're sitting down and adjusting the entire compensation package. Part of our problem is that we don't have many options here to do anything differently than what's been prescribed. And I find that unfortunate in times like this. We have a consumer price index that might be 2%, yet we're giving 6% and 7% raises. And it's out of kilter. And if we had the, I think, opportunity to do less than what is typically prescribed, when we meet a certain threshold, when we operate or our revenue is significantly less than our projected expenses, we ought to be able to, or I would like to see some mechanism by which we can deviate from what has been prescribed so we can better fit the conditions that currently exist, and it would keep us from getting so far apart. And at times like this, it would give us opportunities to be a little bit more creative, a little bit more flexible, to bring the revenue and expense line together, and we just don't have that option available to us, and that's what makes it so complicated. So having that threshold or benchmark by which we can move into a different, say, level of negotiating or a different set of criteria that we use to adjust compensation and that sort of thing. I mean, I don't see the value when inflation, CPI, say, is at 2%, and we're giving 6% to 7% rate increases when we can't balance our budget and we're having to lay people off. I just would appreciate an opportunity to be a little bit more flexible.
Yeah, absolutely, and certainly there's nothing to prevent the employee associations from agreeing to a lesser amount than the prevailing wage survey indicates. They could say, we're going to go with the CPI.
Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on Supervisor Sajian's comments, except that I think that, you know, in some of these structural changes that we're looking at, that Ms. Wilcox laid out some on pension changes that we're looking at. I mean, I understand the arguments against them, and you know, and I think there's a certain amount of validity to it. But I think, you know, I think things are different, and things are going to be different. You know, we're sort of in the land of new truth, and I know Schopenhauer always said that, you know, any new truth is, you know, it's first is ridiculed, then it's violently opposed, and then it's finally treated as self-evident. And, you know, I think that that's where we're at. We're in the new truth, and we're between the ridicule and the violently opposed stage of it. But I think that, you know, you can't sustain the unsustainable. If we can't afford things, we're going to have to make changes. And our jobs are not to just look out for the next couple of years. We may be making decisions for the next 3 years, as you and Mr. Edge lay out for us, but we're really looking out for the future of the county, for 10, 20 years down the line, 30 years down the line. And, you know, the seams are starting to show. And we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to make these changes. And we do have, I agree with Supervisor Patterson, you know, sometimes it feels frustrating to feel kind of handcuffed on the ability. I mean, I guess we have the big stick, which is the thing most of us don't really want to wield, which is layoffs. But, you know, we're looking to work together with everybody in the county that's in this situation, but you know we're gonna have to make some major structural changes. I think that's absolutely required of us.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Supervisor Hill. I agree with colleagues' comments on both sides of me here today. We are in a period of I think what only can be called wrenching change. And if we look back at the last 5 or 10 years, skip this year, skip the year before, but in the years prior to that, you know, we were looking at revenues that were going up in the double digits, certainly in the discretionary non-departmental revenues that fund so much of our general fund positions. And there really was, this discussion was not happening. It did not have to happen. And it was a remarkable period of economic increase. I won't necessarily say improvement, because I think we're seeing the necessary correction here. But like Supervisor Hill, I think we have to look very carefully at the long term. And I think it was Mr. Edge's second slide where his revenue projections and his expense projections. And beyond the gap that we have to close every year, if you remember that slide, you could see that the trend in expenses was higher than the trend in revenues. And that's the long-term challenge that we have. And, you know, it's a balancing act, competing in the marketplace, being fair to employees, and providing the services that we're here as a Board of Supervisors to provide. It will settle out wherever our discretionary or wherever our available funds let it settle out. We need to make wise choices, but I want to make sure that on behalf of the board, it's clear that we're extending the hand to our employee associations to work with us to do the best we can for everyone that's involved in this. And by the notes on the table, I see we have one concluding slide. I didn't know if Ms. Wilcox or Mr. Edge were going to give us the next steps here. Oh, and then we have a couple of public comments to bring here.
Just a quick, before Gail closes it out, just tapping into your theme right now of the long term. Mr. Chairman, just to give you a sense, if we continue the salary increase trend that we've seen over the past decade, ballpark figures, your payroll 20 years from now will be $1 billion a year.
your CAO, who's ever holding this particular seat, will be getting paid $1 million a year. Your patrolling deputy sheriff, maybe I should stick around. Your patrolling deputy sheriffs will be getting $400,000 a year apiece. Your planners will be getting $300,000 apiece. Your janitors will be getting about $175,000 a year. That's, I think, that unsustainability that you're talking about. I can't tell you what a janitor's worth 20 years from now, but clearly, and that's assuming that inflation doesn't take off.
And supervisors will be volunteering their time.
Supervisors will be volunteering their time at that point. And obviously the other issue that you're fully aware of is the same thing on the pension side. For better or worse, as a people, we are living longer. And as a people, we are healthier than we have been. And perhaps most important, so both of those things increase the overall cost of a pension actuarially. And of course, the big piece we're all familiar with is the regression to the mean of investments and what's happening, and the general, seemingly overwhelming conclusion of all the financial analysts that I read, that even once the stock market recovers from its current crash, whatever recovery may mean, you cannot expect, looking forward, that the returns on investment will be anything approaching the returns on investment we've been fortunate enough to see up until last year for the previous 10 to 20 years. What that means is you have a pension trust that bases its return, its actuarial assumptions, on a composite return that averages 7.5% plus or minus a year out of a balanced portfolio of stocks and bonds and real estate. And that's an extremely optimistic annual rate of return assumption based on all of the analyses you see moving forward for the next 10 or 20 years. So everything that we see looking forward suggests you can't sustain the salary increases we've seen in the past decade, and also it suggests that the cost of pension, regardless of whether you change it, and even assuming you don't enhance pension over where it is right now, the cost of carrying the existing pension system will increase significantly faster than inflation on a year-to-year basis. So I think the supervisors have outlined it specifically. You have certain short-term patches that you need to make, and so if we talk about give up a pay raise for a year, freeze a pay raise for a year, those are kind of short-term fixes that may help mitigate layoffs of live bodies and allow more time for attrition. But those don't address that long-term trend issue, and I certainly would commend the board for recognizing that long-term trend is the piece that you really need to start thinking how to fix. You don't, again, like the 20 and 10 or the 30 million, you don't have to fix it all this year, but you do have to keep that end in mind in terms of the decisions you're making beginning with this year.
Mr. Meech.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick comment to follow up on that. Some staggering statistics relative to what those
dollars
would be.
You all want to be a CAO in 20 years, aren't you?
20 years from now, I hope I'm sitting in a rocking chair somewhere. But, and that kind of goes to my point. In the next 10 to 15 years, the demographics of this county will dramatically change. The workforce, the income levels, everything. So I think that in the board's thinking about what we're trying to do, and as Gil mentioned, trying to right the ship, I think that has to play into our thinking about how are these demographics going to change and what is that going to mean to the county to be able to sustain itself.
Thank you. And so next steps.
So full circle from what David outlined during his presentation, we are in the final stages of developing the budget recommendations based on the policies and directions you've given us throughout the year. We will be compiling through May 1st. We're basically doing the narrative portion, the budget message, and then the individual narrative for each fund center. Send it to print around May 1st. On May 19th, we'll introduce it to the board, and that will begin the official public review period of the budget. We'll have copies of the budget in all the libraries. It'll be available online, obviously. And then about a month later, the board will commence public hearings on the proposed budget. Whatever changes or agreements we're able to get with the employee associations will not be built into the proposed budget. It's too late. So we're, and unfortunately anticipating that we're going to have a sort of a, not massive effort, but a big effort. We do a supplemental budget document right after we go to print with the proposed budget. We start working on the supplemental. Usually it's just technical corrections, and it's also the opportunity for department heads who want to come before you and request a different level of funding than the one that the CAO is recommending. So to the extent that any of the employee associations do agree to make changes that could mitigate the number of layoffs or just change the overall appropriation, we could build that into the supplemental budget document. The ones that are mid-contract have thus far indicated that they're not willing to open up their contracts and talk about it. That I guess that could change. Certainly, I think the conversation today is very important, and maybe it will change after hearing about the conversation. But we are in negotiations with the largest unit, and the contract is expiring on June 30th, and so there are opportunities to make a number of changes.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions for our Ms. Wilcox or Mr. Edge, we'll go to the public. We have two requests to speak, Eric Greening followed by David Dugan.
I'm Eric Greening, and I'd like to thank the presenters. I'm glad you're taking this comprehensive look at this time. Obviously, we can't forecast where the broader economy is going. But it is, as you're all saying, not likely to be what it was before. Our recovery, when it happens, will be to a different kind of economy in many ways, or it won't happen. I think overall what this contraction is going to squeeze us down to is to squeeze out the illusions, the money that actually was never there, the fake money. It's probably going to have to squeeze out our assumption we can afford an empire, and it's going to essentially, when we rebuild an economy, it's going to have to be in alignment with ecologic realities and the productive capacity of the people and not rebuild illusions into it. Our current situation locally, as you know, I've questioned the definition of public safety. Obviously, if your house is on fire or a crime is being committed, you want someone there right now. So I don't question the basic premise that public safety is a priority. I have questioned the breadth of the definition. Health care workers save lives. And so, but I think there are a couple of other things that have come up in our current situation. Essentially, the detritus of what's coming down to us from the state catastrophe, where what you're defining as public safety is to some extent mitigated by dedicated funds that are in a section of the partial restoration of the VLF, whereas the biggest hits statewide seem to be in the areas of health, human services, and education. And I hope you consider that when you do sort of shuffle these priorities around within our budget. Health and human services are both areas that in the county, it seems we're all taking for granted, are going to take huge hits, especially given the state raids, the direct raids on things like Prop 10 and Prop 65, but in the broader picture as well. Education, obviously, you don't run school districts, but you do have one education system that is county-run, and that's our libraries. That is the people's education system that's accessible to everyone. It will be the stopgap to the extent that other education is being raided. And so I just hope you consider those broader realities and what is truly being hurt from the state level when you set your local priorities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mr. Dugan, followed by Kim Daniels.
Kim Dugan, Los Osos. I remember several years back when I first started coming before this board on issues other than the budget. I came here talking about how the housing bubble was going to pop and how all these creative financing schemes for people to have home ownership were going to come around and bite us in the you-know-where. And that did happen. And I'm here to give a similar prediction. Supervisor Gibson talked about the one graph showing expected expenditures and expected revenues. And I think you should add or be less cheery with those expected revenues, even though the gap was widening, only because of what's happening with the state and the federal monies. First of all, there's going to be an increase in taxes, which is going to have less investment of funds available for expanding people's businesses. Also, too, there's going to be and new housing starts. There's going to be less investment capital in that area. But I think that these stimulus packages and these bailouts have hurt the economy and going to hurt the economy more than you expect because, again, that's money taken out of the system in a giveaway, basically, to which does not allow the economy to grow naturally, where people can't, there's not investment monies available, not no money to lend. That money's not going to these banks. They're not being used to lend to businesses and such what. And I expect, this is what I expect, is that that revenue curve is going to be flatter. The actual revenue curves are going to be flatter than what's expected, and that you're going to have to expect harder times in the land of plenty, and that you should base your decisions on that fact. And if things are cheerier than that, then go ahead and base new budgets on the cheerier part when you do have those revenues increased. But you don't have any surpluses, you have deficits. And that's what you have to depend upon. Don't look at the pink line as going up. I think it's going to be flatter. I think it's going to be more of less businesses being started in this county, less housing starts in this county, and less people being able to build on lots that are now vacant. And I don't see any revenues actually increasing in the way that Mr. H. portrayed. And that's, some people say, well, he's not presenting a cheery picture, but that's more cheery than I expect in the future, and I think I was right on the housing thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan. Ms. Daniels.
Good morning. I just wanted to say a couple of things. First, I would like to add to something that Gail had said a moment ago, that the bargaining units that are in the middle of a contract have declined to meet and discuss anything with the county. That isn't quite accurate. Our trades and crafts unit was at the table yesterday, and they are in the middle of a contract. One of the things I think it's critical that the board knows is that if you look out in your audience, you'll see one representative from another bargaining unit that is present today. And the reason you don't see the public safety folks is because they are of the opinion that you will not hurt them. You will not touch them. They don't have to engage in conversations about reducing costs because they're untouchable. I represent the single largest bargaining group of the county, and that is 1,800 employees. We are also one of the lowest draws overall on the county budget because so many of the positions that we represent are state and federally funded. And the offsets that we gain as far as salaries and benefits, we would lose if those positions were vacant. We are going to be the hardest hit in what is proposed right now. And it's because your public safety groups do believe that they are untouchable. We are at the table. We are willing to engage in conversations because we believe that despite all our warts and blemishes, we are one family. But we're really sick of the public safety folks believing that they are the rich Beverly Hills cousins and they are exempt from any of the cuts. I have to say it pains me greatly to be here speaking out against other labor organizations. That's not what we do. But I have a job to do, and my job is to make sure the folks I represent are indeed represented and that you hear their message. We are not the biggest draw on the general fund. We are willing to engage and do any number of creative things to try to assist, but everybody that receives a county paycheck has got to be part of this process or we will not succeed. And if we don't succeed, the folks that have engaged with you and tried to assist should be the very last that are adversely affected by your decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Daniels, your name for the record, if we could. And
I'm sorry. Kim Daniels, General Manager, County Employees Association.
And Supervisor Hill has a question for Ms. Daniels.
Just a response to her comment. And Kim, I have great regard for the job you do with your unit, and I come from labor, so I have great respect for labor unions. I can only speak for myself. Nobody's untouchable. That's not where I'm coming from. You know, we have certain priorities and we have certain mandates, but, you know, nobody's untouchable. We're trying to figure out a way to not basically pose one group of employees against another, but to figure out a way to handle this together in the spirit of shared sacrifice so that there won't be animosity and resentment between different parts of our organization. So I just wanted to follow up on that.
Thank you. Thanks, Supervisors. I see a staff light on, Ms. Wilfong.
Just, Kim's absolutely right. I was remiss that Trades and Crafts was at the table. They're not obligated. They're in the middle of a contract. They, once again, have shown they're stepping up to the plate. I say this all the time, but it bears repeating. Trades and Crafts was the only bargaining unit mid-contract that agreed to voluntarily increase their employee pension rates. They're your lowest paid employees, and they stepped up to the plate, and they should be commended for that. The other two bargaining units, the two public safety ones, declined our request for a voluntary increase in the pension rate, and they deserve a lot of credit for that.
Thank you, Ms. Wilcox, for pointing that out. And with that, we'll close public comment. I would only conclude by saying, and sort of taking off a little bit from what Mr. Greening had to say, in looking at balancing this budget, we are taking a comprehensive view, and we're taking a view that tries to get the best job done for the residents of this county that we're elected to represent. And we're well aware that acting smart is absolutely essential to this. And by that I mean putting resources where it gets the job done in the right place at the right time, and not being reactive is certainly one of the core principles that we use. That said, with the resource constraints we have, it's going to be a challenge this year. But I think that this board is up to that challenge. And we'll promise to do the best we can to balance all the various needs of this county and get a county system in place that's going to work for everyone. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Supervisor Gibson. I just want to follow up with that. A tremendous amount of work has gone into getting us where we are today, admin staff, the department heads, and I think state with great assurance that the job isn't done. We don't know what's going to happen at the state level yet. Their budget's still a moving target. They have an estimated $8 billion deficit even after they passed the budget in February. So we can continue to see changes there. And I will only suggest that all of you department heads out there continue to work with your staff to be prepared to present more information, be creative, help us as we move through this process, because I think Ms. Wilcox is right. No sooner will they start printing the budget for 09-10 than they'll have to start with a budget supplement to reflect the changes that are occurring at the state. So we're not through the rapids yet, and please remember that I think the people, as Ms. Daniels mentioned, that are affected the most are the ones that should be included in the process of getting our budget balanced. So please be inclusive, and thank you for your efforts so far.
Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of points. One, in regard to Mr. Dugan's comments on the stimulus, I can't agree more. We need to be really careful about this stimulus, if you will. In a lot of cases, it's not even here. We don't even have it in some regards. Yes, part of it we do, but a lot of it we don't on a lot of programs that are coming down the line. And the other thing, there's a defined timeline which this money comes. And if you start putting programs in place that you're going to have to continue to fund, there won't be any money to fund them. So we need to be very careful about how we address this so-called stimulus. And from the education standpoint, Mr. Green, you're absolutely right in terms of, I was speaking to the
Pascagoula High School superintendent and Mr. Pell from Cuesta College. Cuesta College's enrollment is going up with an older generation of folks coming back in because they're losing jobs. They're trying to find a way to either reposition themselves back out in the workforce. So that's important. And Ms. Daniels, I remember last year reading in the paper input that was given by employees about ideas of ways to do things, and it all came from SOCIA, ways that we could improve the way we do business. And I think that it's important that to recognize the fact those folks have stepped up on a number of occasions. They're one of the first to do so. And I'm not quite sure how to go about this part of it, but in our presentation from the CAO, when he talks about the adopted policies, public safety, planning departments, high priorities, one suggestion I might ask the board to consider, and I'd like to have this considered sooner than later, we have a lot of folks out there that are, not only do we have to recognize our budget, but we have to recognize ways that we can help the public. A lot of people are in between trying to get their projects done and trying to get their financing back in place, and only to find out that the bank won't lend them as much as they thought they were going to get before, or their time extensions are going to be up. I'm asking that if there was a way that we can put an ordinance in place or a resolution giving some grace period for a two-year time frame in which people that are in the process, start it from January 1st, that anything from that point forward doesn't apply. But people that are in the process, the planning process, it allows them a couple of years to get their financing, get their projects moving, and also freeze the fees so that way, if they get a project, say, by September, October, and they come back and find out that the fees have increased, they got to go back to the bank, and they're going to have the same problem all over again. So I'd really like to see a way that the board could assist with that from a planning standpoint, and that I would assume that would reduce a little bit of the planning department's necessity to continue to check on a lot of these permits and the time frames in which they expire. The other point that I just wanted to throw out for the board is the discretionary funds that come from the board per the district. I would think we could either reduce or eliminate them. That would assist with the board's ability to meet its part of the budget as well. So just a couple of ideas to throw out and take it from there, gentlemen.
Okay. Supervisor Hill?
I'll follow. I think Supervisor Sazian, did you want to respond directly?
Go ahead, please.
And I want to encourage department heads, those who are here and those not here, to communicate with us as well. I mean, I would welcome that. You're the experts in your departments, and you have institutional experience that would be valuable. So I would welcome those, that kind of advice or any kind of proposal from our department heads. I know we're all kind of, in the mood of protecting our own turf, but I think some of us have a longer view of things as well. So I think most of us would welcome the input from all of you. Thank you.
Mr. Shajin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me respond to the discretionary funds first.
I knew you were going there.
Yeah, I will be going there for the reasons that some of us have more of advisory councils than others. And advisory councils won't exist if we don't, because the money comes directly from your discretionary funds. If we say we're going to cut back or get rid of the discretionary funds, we will have absolutely no money going towards their expenses, and they're all volunteers. So I think we need to have some input from our advisory councils, all the what ifs. And even though some of the money we give out of our discretionary funds is a feel-good type of a thing, but then think about if we didn't put $5,000 towards Cal Poly students to go count the homeless, that would have never taken place. So there are benefits that it's not just feel good, but it's a necessity. So when we look into it, let's look at it a little more carefully as how much we need and why to get rid of it. If that's the case, yeah, we're all going to bite the bullet. And before I even ask for anybody to take a cut, I'll be sure that that's applied to me personally as well. So we got to set the precedent. I'm very much with Mr. Mitchum about what happens with time extensions. But if I'm not mistaken, because of the feelings, there were a bill that passed last year, I believe, that under certain circumstances, those time extensions are the law to be applied and I'm looking for anybody from the planning department to correct me if that's not exactly what it is. But the other thing is, times like this, we need to take a leadership role and say, those out there, as I made this comment last Tuesday when we had a gentleman here with a development tag that we were able to reduce, are we partnering to stimulate the economy? And if not, I definitely want to be on the same side of the fence, say, what can we do to be sure that those who are taking a risk times like this to invest in our communities, what are we doing to hold hands and make them come through on a faster scale, but not necessarily cutting any corners?
May I respond?
Sure.
Just quickly, and I did speak to staff a little bit about this, and they thought that there were a way that they could bring something to address this issue. But going back to discretionary funds, and I don't disagree that in some cases these are necessary to help establish and get things going. I mean, I've got probably more advisory councils and CSDs than any other district. So the criteria by which the discretionary funds maybe needed to be addressed, as opposed to just it goes wherever it goes. But, you know, I don't know how to say this, but this is the taxpayer's dollar that we're making decisions on for our own, in our own discretionary way. And so in some respects, I don't know that they would want to fund certain things that we may fund. So if we truly are going to be participatory with everyone out there that's trying to find ways to address their part of the budget, then I think we should be doing the same thing. And in any way, shape, or form that we can manage that.
I'm okay with the discretionary part. I just think being thanked for giving away taxpayer dollars is not a particularly virtuous thing, and it's an entirely political thing, and I'm not that comfortable with that aspect of it myself.
Well, I will rise in defense of the community project funds, as they're officially called. Maybe I can give you a little background on some of the details as it relates to the budget, but. Let me go to the details first. Last year, memory serves, the total of discretionary community project funds was $131,000, and split evenly between the five districts, so a little bit over $26,000 apiece, plus whatever is carried over from previous year's appropriation. In the budget, as the department head of the Board of Supervisors department, I put forward a budget that proposed a 10% cut in that, so taking $13,000 off of that for a total of $118,000, which I would propose to split evenly five ways, and I would assume that would be the expectation. Beyond that, the budget that I sent to admin included some significant cuts to our travel expenses. So if we want to attend meetings like CSAC or other educational symposia or planning meetings or whatever it is that we want to do. What I'm proposing is to cut that budget from the Board of Supervisors and allow supervisors to pay for those out of the monies that are in the community project funds as discretionary to whatever they think is most important. And that really brings me back to the purpose of why I think the community project funds are important. As Supervisor Shajian said, funding the advisory councils is my top priority out of my community project funds. They get the first cut because they are a fundamental aspect of grassroots civics that I think is important. Beyond that, in looking at proposals, and the public should know that the way those funds are distributed is that 501c3 nonprofit organizations make application through the admin department, and their application is circulated through all five of the supervisors, and we can decide how much funding we choose to put to any one of the proposals that's put before us. There is a certain amount of things that are specific to a district. In my particular priorities are programs that help children within District 2, and I will largely fund those. You know, if other supervisors want to contribute, that's great. Some projects, either whether they be for children or for the arts or whatever other worthy public purposes, might get support from a breadth of supervisors, and that's the way that it's decided. I think, though, that it is
I think there's a use to it in that for certain projects, supervisors know best what's going on in their districts and know best how a relatively small amount of funding could be put to a very good use. So I certainly think that they are important. We do receive appreciation from those who are funded. That's not my motivation. My motivation is to get certain things done to the benefit of the public within my district and elsewhere in the county. So as to the planning issue, I think one way to proceed, Mr. Meacham, might be to continue your discussion with planning. If planning would like to bring back an item for discussion at a future meeting, we could certainly entertain that, or circulate a memo as to the thoughts there. We can bring it to a public discussion at a point when we think that that's appropriate.
And just a quick response, sure. As far as the discretionary, and I'm glad we can at least have this discussion because we're bound by the Brown Act, so we never know in a lot of cases what each one's thinking until we sit here collectively and go through this. But I can appreciate the need to find ways to help supplement our advisories. I do the same thing in my district. It's these folks do volunteer their time, and it's important that we do that. But it kind of, in a sense, reminds me of CDGB in a way. We have this large amount of requests and this little tiny piece of pie in which we need to slice. And so trying to figure out, okay, how do we do that, I think is going to become even more difficult in these economic times because you're going to have more folks that are trying to find ways to get financial assistance. So anyway, enough said.
Absolutely. There's a whole, in our office, there's a whole budgeting process for those funds that we go through. So
here,
certainly.
If I may, sir.
Sure.
Anytime you spend a penny that's not out of your pocket directly, it's taxpayers' money. So, even with the discretionary funds, we're spending taxpayers' money, but it's also on the agenda. If there is any opposition, they can obviously come. The 10, 11 years that I've been here, there's only been one case that supervisors had a problem with another supervisor wanting to give money from discretionary funds. Where I would feel bad if you choose, Mr. Chair, to have discretionary funds to be spent on meeting trips, CSAC and otherwise, because then I'm spending that money on myself, even though it's business related, and not giving it back to the taxpayers where it came from. So I wish as we move forward, if you were to budget a certain amount to be directly for CSAC needs, that's still under supervisor's budget, whatever your discretion is on that, I will support it from that point of view, but I don't want to mix it with discretionary funds because then there's that conscious kicks in, and if I rather give it to the community, I'm going to keep myself out of it to give it to the community. Do you follow that?
I do, and yeah. And I guess my vision on it is that I see my job as having three distinct roles, three distinct parts. One is to advocate on behalf of the members of my district who elected me. The second part is to be an administrator and legislator for the county as a whole, taking care of that public trust as one vote among five. And the third part is I see myself as being a representative of this county to the outside world, which I think is extremely important. In my view, I'm very careful with what expenses I ask the county to pick up. When I travel to a meeting, I go there because I think that it makes me do my job better by having the information that I gather from abroad.
I'm out of pressure to look at you there.
So within the if we look at the budgeting process, and again referencing Mr. Meacham, while I'm the department head, I have to hold my budget discussions with the department in public because of the Brown Act. We were set a particular target to make in terms of reducing our status quo requests. And because we're a small department, five supervisors, five legislative assistants, and 1.5 clerical staff, and so much of our budget is salary, it leaves very little to cut. And quite frankly, we didn't make the targets that the admin office is asking other departments to make. So I would submit that if it's a discussion we could have, if we wanted to specifically budget for travel, as a group, I would submit that we might be looking at further reduction to community project funds in order to fund that, or we need to find some pot of money to put that, or we let supervisors determine individually how they were to spend that.
We'll see when it spells out
okay.
what it's going to be like.
Okay.
Yeah, and if I may, I was sitting this one out, but I can't resist any longer. I think it's imperative that we make the same level of cuts as we're asking all the other departments to do, or I should say most other departments to do, and there are a variety of ways that we can achieve that, and we can have that discussion as to how we want to get there during the budget hearings, but I would certainly hope that what we submit to admin meets that same threshold that we've asked the majority of our other departments to meet.
And
quickly, Mr. Chairman, too, I just want to kind of throw in my two cents on the reserve issue. I think it's absolutely essential that we maintain the reserve level that we have as best we can, because we have no idea of what we may be confronted with down the line. And I'm talking about, I've been through it before with an earthquake situation, and looking at our reserves, trying to complement what needed to be done at that point in time, and then trying to recoup that money later. So if we ever get into a situation where we're going to need to depend upon these reserves to get us through, if we keep kind of cutting back on some of these reserve capabilities, I have a big concern that we won't be able to meet some of these obligations if and when the time comes. So I personally, I'm real cautious about tapping into the reserves to try to supplement things out of the general fund to keep getting us by, because we're going to be minimizing that ability to do what we need to do later.
Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a final wrap-up comments. I don't agree with Supervisor Patterson's comments, but we'll talk about that in another point, because I do think, touching on Chairman Gibson's comments, that we have certain roles to play, and certainly I see some of the travel and some of the organizations that we belong to as important to not just the board, but to the county itself, so we can have a larger discussion. Just a final flog on the community funds. You know, I think we all agree on the worthiness of them, certainly as far as the advisory councils go, and even in far as the groups that ask for funding. I don't think there's a question on that. I guess I'd probably feel a lot more comfortable if the county of San Luis Obispo were thanked rather than specific supervisors, and it seemed, you know, less a political process and more of a discretionary process of saying, yeah, we have this money to support these causes that come to us, and it's the county that does so rather than any specific individual. So that's just my final comment on that.
Thank you. With that, let me thank admin staff, those at the dais, those sitting in the audience, for the hard work that they do, analyzing. Oops, I should have called another break. I can
tell. It is clearly a new day, Mr. Chairman. I must admit, I don't think I've ever been accused of being too cheery before. So I feel
yeah. my slip of my tongue. We appreciate your analysis of the numbers. That is fundamental to us getting this job done. So with that, I've got two requests to speak on closed session. Let me take those. Lisa Schicker, followed by David Dugan, and then we'll ask Mr. Jensen to comment.
Hi, my name is Lisa Schicker. Previous LOCSD director from 2004 to 2008. I'm here to speak on item number 1A, which is the LOCSD's bankruptcy. I don't know if you guys know this or not, but I was the president the first year of the recall from October 2005 to 2006, and had direct knowledge about the bankruptcy and had lots of closed sessions. Probably in the first 2 months we had 22 meetings that went from 8 to 15 hours long, 93 public commenters, and they were all closed sessions. So I'm very familiar with closed sessions. I don't know, of course, what you're talking about the bankruptcy, but it raised a flag for me because of Montgomery Watson Harza. They are involved in the bankruptcy. That has not been settled, although we have settled with others. And if you are going to talk about Montgomery Watson Harza, if it is anything connected to the selection of them on the short list, I just think it's wise that you talk to me or someone else who is knowledgeable about those goings-on. And the current staff at the LOCSD and the current attorneys aren't those people. It is me and the board that was involved in 2004 and 5 and 6, and it is the attorneys and the staff that were involved then. So if you are to make any decisions in bankruptcy, in this discussion in closed session, I still encourage you to talk to me or one of those people. I think it's important. You may not have the whole story. I would be very happy to help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schicker. Mr. Dugan.
Yeah, Dugan, Los Osos. I had on most occasion took the opportunity to talk about any Los Osos issue that was in closed session. I wasn't going to speak in closed session until I was had this pointed out to you. We're going to talk about the bankruptcy. I want to. She brought Montgomery Watson Harza, and that draws a red flag for me for any issue with they're involved in. But what I'm concerned about, or would like to talk to you about, is the $6.5 million that the state wants back for the SRF loan. It's one issue. They made a bad loan, unsecured. Now, that's been going on. We have bad loans have been going on for quite a while, not just in the state of California. But they did that in an effort, I believe, to force any new CSD board to continue working on a project. They took a gamble. They gambled the state's money. And therefore, I think that somehow or another, there should be some kind of debt forgiveness involved there. Maybe out of this SRF, I mean, out of the stimulus package, there is room for some debt forgiveness. But they made a bad bet that they were going to force the new CSD to continue the project. I'm also want to speak about, as part of bankruptcy, is the $6.6 million in the fine from the regional board. And I believe this board will have the opportunity, if and when or when you take the project, and I believe you will, that you will lobby the regional board to drop the majority of the fine and just have the fine for the time schedule order stay in place, which is around $60,000 for the LCST. So you might want to lobby the regional board in that area, maybe discuss that today, that $6 million is extreme. You can't induce somebody to comply if they don't have the project, and they definitely don't have the money. So that's another area. Also, too, whenever you are talking about Los Osos, you have to keep in mind it's not just the group of people that come here to speak. And some of them may get under your skin, and some of them may rub you the wrong way. I know I have on occasion. But when you speak about or think about our big discussions about Los Osos, you've got to remember it's the whole of the community. That a few of us come down here, we may not necessarily represent, but are speaking what other people haven't been able to come down here to speak. So be kind to us, even in closed session, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan. And with that, Mr. Shajan, you had a comment?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I don't disagree with Mr. Dugan that they made a loan that was unsecured. It's their problem. But if I was to wear my banker's hat on, and if I make a loan unsecured, and the end result is I'm going to eat that, and I'm the only bank in town, and you need another loan in the future, guess what? Because the state is the only where we can go to, if we're going to treat them such, next time we knock on their doors, guess what? They're going to remind us of the bad loan. And if we, in return, tell them it was your bad decision, we're not going to come out of as winners. So just maintain that mentality as we move forward.
Thank you. Mr. Jensen?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have somewhere between 1 and 2 hours of items to consider on closed session, probably closer to 2 hours.
Okay. So we will reconvene when closed session is done. And I just, if for the listening public, there's not a public comment period listed for the afternoon. If there are folks in the audience at that point who have not spoken in general public comment today and who would like to do so, I will recognize them for general public comment. The one challenge to that is it's not 100% certain exactly when we're going to be back down here to close out closed session. So with that,
Thank you.
We're not going to convene at 1:30. We're going to convene.
Whenever.